Tonight on The Download, from the organization Cool Classics, Mara Tapp, our Monday evening quarterback with Adam Hogue, and live music in Studio 435 with The Safes. Now, here's your host, a man who wants to know if the same technology behind driverless cars could be applied to doing laundry, Justin Kaufman.
Right? Blowing your mind.
I'm mind blown.
Could you imagine if you had a robot, like the robot from Rocky 3 that's just kind of hanging out?
I'll do your laundry.
Just in an app, all your clothes magically float to the washer and dryer? I'd rather have that than driverless cars. What's up, everybody? Justin Kaufman back from New York City. You must know from following my Instagram story. I was all over Instagram story this weekend, just like painting. Just hey, take a look at me in front of this building. Take a look at me in front of this graffiti. Look at this cool cobblestone road. That's me not smiling. I had a lot of fun, though. Went out there for my anniversary. It's fun to go out. We decided at one point that we would always go out on a weekend around the anniversary because it's kind of the week before Thanksgiving, so it's really cheap. It's a lot cheaper because everyone's getting ready to go the next week somewhere. And so the stuff to New York is super cheap. That's what's so annoying in highway robbery about spring break. The idea that they know that everyone's traveling, so we're going to jack it up $300 more. But this was cheap. And last year we went to New York City, if you listen to this program, and had a great time. This year did the same thing. Decided let's do it again. Just go to different neighborhoods. You can go to so many different neighborhoods in that city and not touch the other one and have a whole different experience. So great time had by all, and it was fun. But it's great to be back in Chicago. What a beautiful day today. And to come back to work here on Michigan Avenue for The Download, to see all of the decorations that are up, not just in our studio, but along Michigan Avenue after the Festival of Lights this weekend, the Disney parade. It's magical. It's Pete Zimmerman's favorite time of the year. I think that's how the song goes. Oh, we got a great show tonight. Coming up, we'll do Touche. Chris Veronis in for Chris Roebling. Dave Lundy as well will be here. Talk about Trump. Sure. I think I'm just going to go, how are we doing, fellas? And then just go get some coffee. Later in the 8 o'clock hour, the Monday evening quarterback with the Chicago Bears. Some interesting observations. And Adam Hogue, who joins us, 312-981-7200. He's just spot on about you can't have it both ways, Bears. They play a good game. They finally start to use their rookies. But on the final drive of the game, Tariq Cohen, Jordan Howard, and Adam Shaheen all on the bench. Not trusted with the plays by the coaching staff. The guys that got you there in week 11. It's one thing to say, hey, you know, these guys are rookies. They just don't know. But you're seeing rookies all over the league make contributions. And if they're not ready for the two-minute drill at the end of the game, which Mitchell Trubisky was brought in to do, and John Fox's game plan, essentially that's the goal, is to be close at the end of the game. There is no blowouts. He doesn't care about dominating. He's like, as long as we're within winning or losing by 3 points with about a minute to play. It's surprising to me that the guys that were making plays all game long were not in the game at the end of the game. And, of course, the kicker. We'll talk about that. 9 o'clock, Mara Tapp is in studio. So excited. Mara Tapp, longtime journalist. Used to work with her when I was fresh behind the ears. I was maybe 19. I was an intern. And for the first 2 or 3 years of my career, I would sit in on Mara Tapp's meetings in the morning when she worked in public radio. And I learned a lot about how to do the job and what it takes to do this kind of work from her. She has moved on from journalism. She still writes. She's a freelancer, but she's behind Cool Classics, which just got a great national award for their work. We'll talk with her about it. Also, Deb Perlman's here from Smitten Kitchen, one of the greatest and original food blogs out of New York City. She's got a new cookbook. We'll talk. And the Safes are back. Rock, garage rock, I guess you'd call it, garage band. Be back to rock Michigan Avenue tonight, Studio 435. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. I have so much to talk about my trip. I was just looking at my notes on my phone. I just spent 2 hours. We should come in on Thanksgiving, Pete, and I should just talk about the weird things that happened to me in the last
Yeah, let's do it.
For one, I'll say this quick because I want to get the carryout. My dad taught me from an early age, cash only in cars. Like, that's why Uber and Lyft, like, cash only when you get a cabbie, right? Don't mess with the credit cards. It's not a good idea. They're going to rip you off, or that's not going to work. So I had the cash to do this every time I go on a trip, right? Even in New York. And my wife was like, the night before we were getting a pizza, she's like, use the cash. It's 2017. Take the cash. I go, like, you're right. You know what? Every car is equipped for credit cards.
Yeah.
We get to the hotel, and the credit card machine won't work. And the cabbie, my wife was like, your problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? And I couldn't do it because I knew the guy was going to get ripped off. He didn't do anything wrong, you know? And so I had this hilariously tense first 10 minutes in New York having to go find a cash machine.
Oh, while people are waiting for you?
Yeah, like, no, but I just went to the deli, you know, and the deli one didn't work after it spit out the receipt. You know, it was just like, I think I intimidated New York with my language of when I yelled at the deli guy because he goes, oh, that machine doesn't work. And I'm like, you tell me that before, and with much more colorful language, the whole deli like looking at me. And then the same when I had to go around the block with the cab driver, he goes, you are a good guy. You know, you're a good guy.
And because, like, you wanted to pay him.
Because I was accommodating him, even though his machine was
broken. Because, yeah, you could have.
I could have just said, take, you know, too bad. So sad, but I didn't.
There was an episode where that happened to me, dropped off at my house, where his credit card machine didn't work. And I may have been mouthy about it, and he called the police.
He did?
Yeah, and within 30 seconds, 8 squad cars.
and an ambulance.
And they're like, can you just pay the guy? Because I was like, yeah. Right. So they walked with me to the cash machine.
Oh, that's not right. Yeah. Okay, we need to do 2 hours on this.
All right.
Soon. Maybe not tonight, but soon we're doing 2 hours on her. It's a download. Here's a carryout. All right, here today is top stories. The Justice Department sues to stop AT&T's merger with Time Warner, saying that the deal's bad for the country. This after it was leaked that the Justice Department wanted CNN to be sold to have this merger go through, but both parties said no. And so the Justice Department's suing. Hey, I'm all for big mergers being evaluated, but it's hard to believe that this is all about, quote, the interest of the country, since it seems that big companies getting bigger is the business plan of our president. I mean, isn't that what big business hired him for? I'm totally confused. Yeah, hopefully this will be cleared up soon. In local election news, former Cook County Board President Todd Stroger back. He's challenging Tony Preckwinkle for his old job. I mean, he did win the election to be Cook County Board President fair and square when his dad won the Democratic primary while in a coma. And then they just changed the first name on the ballot. Take out John. Let's go with Todd. They'll never know. I mean, that's fair and square, right? How about this? Can we just give Stroger his leather high back chair? That's what he just wants it. He just likes the way it feels when it spins around and around and around and around and around. Just give him the chair. At a discounted price, not free. But give him a chair. Senator Al Franken has a second accuser. A woman came forward saying that he groped her at a Minnesota fair back in 2010, grabbing her behind while taking a photo. What's with guys grabbing girls' butts during photos? Right? The DJ with Taylor Swift, former President George H.W. Bush, Charlie Rose, now allegedly Al Franken. And also, that's your move? Get him looking at the camera and then goose him? What? Are millennial douche guys, they're grab-assing too? Or is that something that's just generational douchery? My dad and his granddad and his granddad before him taught me the best way to get a woman's attention is to pose and grab. Pose and grab. Give me a break. Uber buys up thousands of driverless Volvo SUVs. Uber, of course, looking to right its one fatal flaw in its business plan. People. I swear, though, if Uber goes driverless and that Volvo tries to take me on the expressway at rush hour to go from one neighborhood to another, I hope it picks up my passive-aggressive tone. Also, will GPS just blame GPS? I don't know. It's the GPS.
I don't know. It's the GPS.
In weather, mild. In sports, Bears did everything they could, and they still lost yesterday to the Lions at Soldier Field. They say football's a game of inches, but in this case, the case of Connor Barth's last-second missed field goal, I'd say the football's a game of feet. Several wide feet. Barth missed right, and the Bears lost 27-24, and because I guess the Bears believe in accountability now, they waived Connor Barth today and picked up Cairo Santos, the former Chiefs kicker and FanDuel favorite, just for his name. It was a good day for QB Mitchell Trubisky, who did not turn the ball over. He scrambled on a 4th and 13 to get a first down to keep the game alive. He's given us some hope for the future as the Bears are now 3-7, and get this, 0-4 in the NFC North. I'd say it's a really tough division this year, but it's not. The division winner will probably be the only team that gets to the playoffs from the North. Other bad news, Leonard Floyd injured his knee and he was carted off the field, out for the season. But in classic Bears, there's good news. From what Coach Fox tells us, there's no ACL tear, and that just would have been worse. Just MCL, so he's out for the year, but ACL would have been this season and half of next. So, yay! We'll miss seeing Floyd on the field for the remainder of the games, but who are we kidding? We're probably not going to watch. Also, enough NFL. So many players that we want to watch out for the season, right? I know you don't care about the players, but I'm not going to watch because you put a guy who was working at a Lowe's a minute ago in as middle linebacker, right? We do have some affinity to these players. Learn, like I said, man, robots, right? Have robots play the game of football. I'll love a robot as much as I love a person. Simple as that. Right now, the Bears 3-7 record puts them one game better than this time last year when they were 2-8. So that is improvement. Where are we with Bulls basketball? Anyone paying attention to this squad? I set up alerts on my phone for Bulls news and scores, and it doesn't even care. Doesn't even tell me. We started this year the circus trip out west. This year there's no circus, but they're going out west anyway. They started losing to the Suns and Phoenix. They get the Lakers next tomorrow night. They're 3-11 on the season and percentage points ahead of the Atlanta Hawks for the worst in the Eastern Conference. The Bulls. College football, Northwestern smoked Minnesota to run their record to 8-3, 6-2 in the conference. Not bad. They finished the season on Saturday against the Illini, who they're bad. Lovey is 0-8 in the Big Ten, although he did beat the spread in losing to Ohio State. So the spread was 41, and they lost by 38. So that's a win. Not a great weekend for the Northwestern Wildcats basketball program. They got lit up by the Red Raiders of Texas Tech, Pete's team. Lost by 30-plus points. The AP rankings came out, and we're no longer number 20. We're no longer anything. With the two losses to unranked teams, something tells me the Wildcats are going to be underdogs from here on out. And finally tonight, Charles Manson died this weekend. Wow, for most of you, you're well aware of the evil serial killer who became one of the world's biggest criminals of all time. For a younger generation, no, he's not Marilyn Manson's dad. I mean, that would make sense, but... All right, that's the carryout for November 20th, 2017. Hey, we're getting rid of those little straws to stir coffee with. Man up. Swirl it around with your wrist. Or if you have to, dip a pinky in. All right, coming up, Touche with Chris Veronis and Dave Lundy. After that, we'll do Monday Evening Quarterback with Adam Hoge. Lots to talk about. 312-981-7200. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Welcome back from New York City. Hey, how you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
That's it.
I gotta say, I was the aggressor. I was the shoulderer.
You know, so you went like all rogue.
I upped my Chicago. So when we walked up through Midtown, the Times Square, and all the street hawkers and the little creatures that get in your face when they want to take a picture around Times Square. I mean, I was like, get out of my face.
But did you have like a little John Travolta Saturday Night Fever kind of hitch in your get along going, you know, kind of dip the shoulder every third step, you know, like.
I should have. I went way too Chicago. I was like, I had like skipped the pleasantries. Like I left the pleasantries at home. So I got so somebody came up to me and tried to sell something or ask me what my religion was or anything like that. I was so ready for it. I was at DEF CON 5.
So would you tell them your religion was?
Well, this is a weird thing. I want to talk about it. This weird thing in Times Square in front of Madison Square Garden, and yeah. Hasidic Jews who will say, are you Jewish? They'll go up to every white guy. So are you Jewish? And you're like, no. And they'll come up and they just follow you and they want to hand you stuff that's about literature about their religion. And my friend who lives there and he works in Midtown says it's gotten amped up. It gets amped up around Hanukkah, and it's like they just accost and are aggressive with mostly white dudes.
I did that one time, and they came up, and I get it. This is what they have to do as kind of a rite of passage. But they came up and asked me if I was part of the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints, mm-hmm. and I turned to him. I said, no, but I am seriously considering it.
And they're like, they didn't know what to do.
Like, all of a sudden, they get an answer in the affirmative.
We got one.
And they had no idea where to go after that. I said, I got to go.
No, mine was get out of my face. I got to, like, get a lot of looks. Give him a lot of looks. Anyway, good to be home.
Welcome back.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
That's right, it's Touche, 720 WGN. Dave Lundy and Chris Veronis in for Chris Roebling here tonight to debate, well, to just argue about national politics. One
debate
Democrat,
is really
one
more erudite than we had in mind, Justin.
Yeah, there's no clock. So let's get right to it. Let's talk about, why don't we talk about the issues that are on the table? We'll get to the Alabama Senate race and Al Franken as well in this conversation. But let's start with tax reform. We saw over the weekend that there's one Republican senator that says they're not interested in supporting it. There's another that might be on the fence. Are we heading closer to what we saw with the repeal and replace of health care, or is this just the media stirring up stuff and this is going to pass and give everybody an early Christmas present, as the president says?
I thought the margin in the House was impressive and convincing, and it was a big feat, and it could have been a lot tighter. And, you know, there's a lot of give. Mick Mulvaney said, on the Sunday morning talk shows that they're willing to take out Obamacare if that's a dead letter for Murkowski or Collins. So I think you could see something. And you know, it's about time, too, because the last time we've had tax reform was 1986. And people are screaming for relief. Not just companies, which are the highest tax in the world, but across the board. There's something in it for everyone in this tax reform.
So I'm afraid my friend Chris slept through the decade of the 2000s. He apparently forgot the Bush tax cut in 2001.
That's never mentioned, yeah.
And then the second Bush tax cut in 2003. Yeah. And what's you know, so here's the thing. You know, Roebling likes to do this too, so it must be something
with the Chris,
with guys named,
right?
Chris sitting at that microphone, who love to pretend this is reform. And yes, the air quotes are for the vote folks watching on the internet, reform. But the reality is, this is not reform. These are just tax cuts. It's redistribution from the middle class to the upper class. The biggest mind blower of this entire affair is the notion that this is going to somehow create economic growth and jobs. We've done this before. We've done this in the United States. We've done this in Kansas, which is part of the United States. We've done this all over. The Republican experiment with tax cuts has been tried and failed again and again and again. These tax cuts will not pay for themselves. Nobody believes that and says it with a straight face. And to your question, Justin, of are we about to go through the healthcare thing? Absolutely we are.
You really think that
Absolutely.
The Senate's not going to get it done?
No way. Because the problem is the numbers don't add up. And so for every senator who wants to cut the medical who wants to restore the medical expense deduction, which, by the way, you should, because it's outrageous that they're cutting that, or who wants to restore the student loan interest deduction, well, between those two, I believe that's $270 billion. So, okay, where are you getting the money from? And these numbers don't add up. It's going to balloon the deficit. And when CBO gets done scoring this thing, Republicans aren't going to know what to do with themselves.
You know, I'm astounded how, but not surprised, how Democrats can manufacture all these reasons of why people can't keep more of what they earn, quite honestly. You know, in 1986, the growth rate
was 5%.
It's called math, Chris. 5%, and yet they still did it because they realized inflation pushes income into higher income brackets, and so they fixed that with indexing taxes. We need relief today.
Why do we need relief?
For job creation.
And who needs relief?
Small businesses.
This is not helping small businesses.
All businesses.
That's true. The one senator, the Wisconsin senator, came out saying this doesn't help small businesses.
And that's why the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the number one small business advocacy organization, opposes this thing.
Chris's point, what he's making is the fact that there is a need. There has been a clamoring for less taxes, less burden on business.
No, there has been a clamoring among Republican donors for give me my tax cuts, damn it. You're in control of the whole government. That's what this is about. This isn't even about the Republican base. This is about the Republican donor class who is saying, we want it now. It is our turn.
The average family is going to get $1,200 of relief over the next 10 years.
No, they're not.
Businesses are going to be able to reinvest.
No, they're not.
Or they're going to do stock buybacks, but that still benefits investors.
You know what happened.
It benefits 401ks.
You know what happened when Gary Cohn.
80% of all people have got some kind of 401k.
You know what happened when Gary Cohn went before 300 CEOs. And before 300 CEOs, he said, okay, I'd like a show of hand. How many of you are going to reinvest if they cut the taxes? And the answer was 5 hands went up out of 300. And then he said, wait, oh, come on. More of you aren't you going to do it? And they're like, no, because that's not what business does.
All businesses in the country are small businesses. That's where the job growth is.
I do run a small business.
That's where the job growth is.
That's right.
Small businesses, half the output comes from small businesses.
Then why are you discriminating against small businesses in fact, the original tax proposal said that S-Corps and LLCs, which are the kind of business that Veronis and I own, that you will be taxed at a lower rate. We're going to cut your taxes down to either 20 or 25%.
Yeah, how is that not pro-small business?
Because that's not actually what they're doing. They then went back and they said, in fact, we'll only do that if you're a passive investor. If you actually are involved in running the business like you and I are,
Whose tax bill?
I believe that's the Senate tax bill.
Well, yeah, and you do realize that the House has got its own version.
Yes.
You do realize this has got to go through reconciliation.
They're both horrendously bad.
Is it going to be done by Christmas time?
No.
Trump says?
I hope so.
No way. By the way, Ron Johnson will vote for this thing in the end. They'll give Ron Johnson something, but there are a bunch of legislators who are not going to vote for it.
Dave Lundy, Chris Veronis, we're too touché tonight. After that, we'll come back and we will talk about Roy Moore and Al Franken and politics of harassment, I guess we'll talk about. We'll see. All right. Touché. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché! Dave Lundy, Chris Veronis in studio, arguing about national politics on this Monday. Lots to talk about. Why don't we get into a second accuser comes out against Senator Al Franken. Liberals are asking for him to resign his seat as senator. Of course, we still are finding out way, way more about the senatorial candidate, Roy Moore, and he has said he's not stepping down. And we heard Kellyanne Conway, in a strange, backhanded way, give an endorsement to Roy Moore.
Yeah, it wasn't really backhanded. It was pretty
straight
frontal.
Straight ahead.
It was full frontal.
Let me ask you guys this, because obviously we can go one at a time. Why don't we start with Roy Moore? I mean, is there a point in this? Because it seems like the Republican playbook when it comes to being accused of this stuff is just saying, no, I didn't. And they don't actually do the apology that you see, the Harvey Weinstein kind of, or the Louis C.K., or even Al Franken came out with that, yes, this happened, I'm sorry I did it. With Roy Moore, he's like, no, I didn't. The lawyer came out on whatever it was, Wednesday or Thursday, saying, let's see the yearbook photo. Like, they're going full on, not unlike the president did in his accusations.
Well, I think what's happening, and if Kellyanne Conway, if her interview was a suggestion of this, is that they're doubling down on what Alabama Republicans are doing, which is digging in and hanging tough. And it's a dangerous decision. It's one that's kind of appalling. But Alabama Republicans have made up their minds that it's us versus them. And we'd rather have a guy accused of pedophilia instead of a pro-choice Democrat. I think Kellyanne Conway, I think the Democrats are fanning those flames. They want another candidate. They want to keep that seat. And again, Dave, this is Thanksgiving, and in the spirit of Thanksgiving, I will say this is a mistake, right? And I'm all for any kind of establishment Republican sleight of hand that preserves that seat and gets Roy Moore out of there, whether it's Luther Strange resigning and triggering a special election, which I know is a long shot.
I didn't think about that.
But I'd be all in favor of that.
Dave, can Democrats, I mean, obviously, they can win in the sense that they say this guy shouldn't be there, but it's not like they can win any sort of moral high ground when you have situations like Al Franken that are out there right now dominating headlines.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not going to defend Al Franken if he did what Leanne Tweeden said he did. You know, that's not good. And
he
apologized for it. That doesn't actually mean he did it. It just meant the appropriate thing to do is apologize for it. But if the woman today is correct, and apparently she posted it contemporaneously on Facebook, if he in fact, you know, posed for a picture with her as a United States senator and grabbed her butt, guess what? She ain't the only one. So if he grabbed one butt, he probably grabbed hundreds of butts. And you're going to hear about that again and again and again. This is a bipartisan, this is a nonpartisan problem. But the difference is there are distinctions. We actually were talking about this last Friday at my lunch is, you know, you can conflate all these different acts from I grabbed her butt to I sexually assaulted her. And they're not the same thing. What Roy Moore did to underage girls is not the same thing as grabbing the butt. They're both wrong, but one of them is way, way, way wrong. And Roy Moore is a reprobate who has no business in the United States Senate.
Why doesn't, Chris, and you've been in this business for a while, you're a consultant, why doesn't the White House just separate themselves from this? Why are they playing games where the president will come out and tweet against Al Franken, obviously because he considers him a rival in politics, but why not just come out and say Roy Moore if he did this bad, sad, made America great again? I don't understand.
I think the White House, Donald Trump has made the decision that this is my base. I need that extra vote, and I'm going to double down on this. That's the calculation that they made. It's craven.
Kellyanne Conway said
it's
craven
kind of
politics. Yeah. It's a reflection of our politics today, which is broken. It's us versus them. I want to make an important point here, though, because what Kellyanne Conway did, honestly, quite honestly, there is no difference between that and Gloria Steinem giving a one free grope to Bill Clinton. Because arguably the mouth of the river on this is Bill Clinton. The White House then that dispatched this SWAT team of apologists that buried the accusers, all the accusers, including Hillary Clinton. There's no difference. There's no difference between the piggery of Donald Trump or the sexual
let me put it this way.
Bill Clinton.
But can
there's
I just
no
say
daylight.
That, you know, I just to copy what John Oliver talked about in his program, the final episode of the season, where he says, whataboutism, which is taking over politics, where you'll see it on all different places where we'll be talking about Roy Moore and
people will
say, Bill Clinton.
It's true.
Bill Clinton did bad stuff and he was impeached.
He was impeached.
Yeah. But the point being, that has nothing whatsoever to do with Al Franken or Roy Moore happening to
him.
Donald Trump and his nine accusers, and the biggest accuser of all was Donald Trump himself, who admitted to sexual assault on tape.
Agreed. Yes.
You're going to call 100%. For him to resign? Are we going to call for Donald Trump to resign?
I don't know if he should resign. He got a pass over that, quite honestly. You know? And you know, arguably, Bill Clinton got a pass.
He was impeached!
Through the 98 election.
He was impeached! Come on! I mean, you know, look, Bill Clinton, you could say what you want, and I'll be happy to say a lot of bad things about Bill Clinton and his behavior, because a lot of his behavior was outrageously bad, and it shouldn't have happened.
Can we agree on this?
What do you want to agree on?
Can we agree?
Yeah, let's agree on something.
That there's no daylight between Donald Trump and Bill Clinton.
No, I cannot agree on that.
When it comes to sexual predation.
No, I can't agree on that at all.
Or sexist piggery. There's no
difference. Morally. No. Hell, just the things that Donald Trump admitted to on Howard Stern's show. I walked through the Miss Teen USA pageant dressing room with them naked so that I could see them, and these
one
bodies
of these
were amazing.
One of these presidents has a rape accusation.
Actually, both of the presidents have a rape accusation.
Well,
and there's a redeeming thing. Happy Thanksgiving.
At least we can agree on that.
I think whataboutism, to your point, is a lazy man's excuse to get out of a tough call, quite honestly.
Well, I wonder, though, it stops any sort of argument or 100% conversation.
Agree.
It just stops in the
100%
track.
Agree.
I thought that was really great because he showed, you know, I think that Democrats and Republicans, I think far too often people want to retreat to their areas and defend. And like you said, Democrats or Republicans in Alabama are digging in. They're getting tough over this.
Yeah.
And
it worked for Trump.
I wonder if that's...
It worked for Clinton, too.
It didn't. I mean, at the end of the day, Al Gore was...
Clinton stayed in office.
Yeah, he stayed in office because what the actual thing he got impeached over was a joke. It was a Republican joke.
It says you.
No,
obstruction of justice,
I'm sorry.
And perjury.
Newt Gingrich philanderer.
I mean, look.
Robert Livingston philanderer.
Right.
Henry Hyde with his, quote, youthful indiscretions.
Now you're doing the what about. But, okay, let me wrap up here.
The people who were accusing him were just
come up
where are
right
we, where are we as we wrap up? I need the last question. We've got to do it quick. As we look to the idea of the 2018 midterms, is the Trump effect and everything that's happening, is it having any effect on the local races and the national races?
Oh, hell yeah.
I mean, are we going to see an impact on everything that's swirling in Washington, D.C. on voters next year?
There was a Republican, there were serious gale force headwinds in the face. Now those gale force winds have turned into a hurricane against Republicans next year.
Chris,
it is going
to
be a hell of a difficult thing.
1 week is a lifetime in politics. And we got a whole year till the election.
And Donald Trump proves that every week. He really does. I'll give him that. Dave Lundy, Chris Varonis in studio for Touche.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys. Thanks for being here.
This will be a 46-yard field goal try by Connor Bork. Snap, hold, not even close.
Wow.
Holy Moses.
Wow.
You can just tell those announcers were so done with the Bears at that point. Not even close. It's time for the Monday Evening Quarterback. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. And our guy, Adam Hogue, joins us. Adam, of course, WGN Radio's Bears beat reporter. You can find out all of his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears, including his podcast. I got to say, the Bears lose 27-24. We just heard the clip of the missed field goal. And Connor Barth was waived after the game. Adam, good to talk to you. And I asked the question, just I asked Martyr in the news, is it better radio to talk to grouse about the Bears losing or to rejoice them winning?
Unfortunately, we're kind of at that point. That was a great call from Tom Brenneman.
Yeah.
I mean, he just like perfectly summed up the feelings of the Chicago Bears fans, right, in two words. Holy Moses. Because I don't think anyone really had any faith that Connor Barth was going to make the kick anyway, and then it wasn't even close. And it's an interesting thing because the games are all national. They're not across the whole country, but the way that the NFL does these games is different broadcasters every week. It's not like other sports where teams have their home announcers.
Right.
But Tom Brenneman and Chris Spielman did the game last week, too. So they had back-to-back weeks with the Bears. Now, I don't get to hear what they're saying live during the game because I'm at the game. But when I go back and I watch the tape, I hear most of it. And I thought that those two, it was almost like they had become the Bears announcers because they were playing everything off of last week's game. I thought Chris Spielman's analysis was great. You could tell like he was accurately comparing what Trubisky did this week compared to last week and some of the steps he was taking and some of the mistakes and fundamental mechanical things that were going wrong for him too. And then just the feeling at the end with the missed kick, Tom Brenneman summed it up perfectly.
Look at us. It's Monday Evening Quarterback, and the first thing we're talking about is the announcers. I think the announcers did well. That's where we're at with the Bears right now.
Yeah.
I love it. All right, so let's talk about this game because I thought, I watched it late because I was on an airplane and I came in. And I thought watching the game, I was like, well, this isn't that bad of a game. The Chicago Bears have run the ball well. They're letting Trubisky the play calling early on. At least, I mean, if they could have ended the game at halftime, even though they were losing, they were having the first quarter and a half. Everything was working right. The defense was stopping the Lions. I mean, besides a fumble, that went awry there, a fumbled snap, it seemed like the Bears were kind of in control from the get-go.
Yeah, they were, and I think we got to give Dowell Loggins credit because, even if he was pressured into it or whatever, he put together a pretty good game plan, especially in the first half. And the thing that I struggle, though, with, Justin, is it's like if we had just taken everything that we talked about last Monday and made a game plan out of it, that was the game plan. And I'm not trying to, like, take all the credit for it. What I'm just trying to point out is how common sense and obvious this stuff
right,
was.
Right, right.
It shouldn't take an NFL offense coordinator to figure out what was going wrong. It didn't. It was like common sense the fans can figure out. And it's play Tariq Cohen, your best player. And the amazing thing is after we talked last Monday, John Fox and Dow Loggins met with the media during the week, and they said everything that we said. Tariq Cohen commands double teams. He gets extra attention from defenses. And I'm just sitting there going, well, then play him. Put him out there and take advantage of that. And, you know, to his credit, Dow Loggins built a game plan around Tariq Cohen, playing Cohen and Jordan Howard off each other a lot. You know, a couple of those big run plays by Howard were off of fake passes. So it was Trubisky would fake a quick pass to the outside to Cohen, who was lined up in the slot,
right,
and that would freeze the linebackers or make a linebacker go over towards him, and it opened up the middle of the field for Jordan Howard to run right up the middle. I mean, this is easy stuff, but they got it out there this week, and they executed. Even though the Bears lost, you know, the offense took a step forward. Just the frustrating thing is, it's like, come on, this could have been going on weeks ago.
You know, also, and you point this out in your piece today, and it's something that I didn't think about when watching the game, but now I'm as livid reading your piece, that those playmakers that you talked about, and Tariq Cohen being one, Adam Shaheen being another, who we saw have a great first half and making plays down the seam, Gronkowski style, even Mitch Trubisky. I mean, this concept, these rookies need to play and they need to be let to be played. All of that, including Jordan Howard, seemed to, I don't know, hit the sideline on that last drive where the Bears needed points. It seemed that Fox and Loggins did not necessarily trust those rookies, and they weren't in the game at crucial times at the end of that ballgame. I don't understand.
Yeah, Adam Shaheen, Tariq Cohen, and Jordan Howard did not play a single snap on the final drive. Now, you can say that the Bears still got in field goal range and Connor Barth should have made the kick. Sure. But just because, and I always take note of this. I mean, I don't always evaluate, or I try not to evaluate everything just off the results. You know, the Bears might win a game and play horribly. Well, that doesn't mean we ignore everything that they did horribly. You know, you have to go back to the logic behind what's being called, what's being run, and I have been watching the personnel very closely the last few weeks. So even though Trubisky managed, and I would say he pretty much did it on his own, especially considering he had that 4th-and-13 scramble.
Unbelievable, yeah.
That was a miracle after three straight plays got screwed up because no one was open, and then he took a sack. You know, I thought the personnel had something to do with that. And I'm struggling to understand. Well, I understand their explanation. I still take exception to it. And the explanation that John Fox has given us the last 2 days, and Tariq Cohen actually talked about this too after the game yesterday in the locker room, is that Cohen's not part of the two-minute drill because he doesn't know the plays in the two-minute drill. He's learning a lot of different positions, and they haven't had him learn that specific package. And a lot of people have read that like, well, why can't he pick up the plays? Does he have like a Devin Hester problem where he doesn't know the plays? I look at it more like they're just taking that off his plate because he's dealing with so much. They haven't taught it to him.
Because you said this, and you said this on this program, Tariq Cohen is being talked about by the coaching staff. He picks up the plays, a smart guy, understands the game that he's playing. So it's not that he can't understand what they're doing in the two-minute offense.
Right, you can't say that he's so intellectually sound and smart, he's picking up everything fast, and then come back and say, well, he doesn't know the two-minute package, unless it's your fault that he doesn't know the two-minute package.
He was not.
You haven't asked him to learn that.
Right.
And I have a big problem with that, because you just saw an entire game plan built around him, and it was successful because of the coverage he dictated. And Josh Sitton, who doesn't talk to the media a lot, but when he does, is really good and really thoughtful, spoke to us today at Hallis Hall, and he said he's never seen a running back that gets that much attention from defenses, that coverage that rotates his way. So again, I just get back to, that's the most crucial plays in the game, and he's not on the field. And it wasn't just him. Adam Shaheen was having a great game, not on the field. Jordan Howard, not on the field mainly because he can't catch. But I go back to that there was 1:35 on the clock when you got the ball, and you had three timeouts.
Yeah, why not use him as a decoy, right?
You still could have put him out there and at least given the threat of running or even handed the ball off once. You had the timeouts. You had plenty of time. So I don't like that those guys aren't in the two-minute package, and I think going forward they better be.
It's week 11. That's the part. These aren't, yeah. It's not that you could say they're rookies. That's fine, but it's week 11. So now Adam Hoge on the line, WGN Radio, covers the Bears for us. Monday evening quarterback, 312-981-7200. Craig's on the line. I got some texts that are also coming in. We'll continue. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us.
Second down and 8. They pitch it to Cohen, and he is sniffing the end zone and leaps into the end zone, and it is a touchdown for Cohen.
Explosive. Let's get him in the game plan, coach.
There you go. That was an explosive play, Tariq Cohen, and the Bears lost to the Lions yesterday. It's a Monday evening quarterback. We've got lots to talk about and a guy to talk with. Adam Hoge, of course, WGN Radio covers the Bears. Find it all at WGNRadio.com/Bears. Lots still to talk about tonight. Mitchell Trubisky's on my list, and I want to talk about that. And then I also want to talk about, of course, Leonard Floyd and the injury sustained in the second, late in that game, based on Kyle Fuller bumping into him. Let's first talk Mitchell Trubisky. I have to say that we're watching a rookie quarterback. And he's learning as he goes, and it seemed like maybe after that first start on Monday Night Football, he got very conservative in the way that they weren't letting him throw the ball, 8 passes, 14 passes, whatever it might be. And now you're starting to see him, whether it's throwing on first down or getting a chance to air it out to receivers, look like the quarterback that the Bears thought they drafted.
Yeah, I think he's played pretty well over the last 2 weeks, and I had this game as his second-best game, only behind that win over the Ravens in overtime last month. So, look, there were certainly some bad throws. He actually had a handful of throws that were inaccurate. Of course, the one that Cunningham right at the goal line stands out. There was, I saw some people getting on logins for the play calling in the third quarter when they had the ball at midfield, but Trubisky missed back-to-back passes high. He had guys open and didn't hit them. So I don't fault the play calling. If anything, Loggins came out throwing there, and that was almost refreshing to see. So, but I also thought Trubisky bounced back from a lot of those, inaccuracies and would fire a dart. You know, that throw to Shaheen early in the game across the middle that got him into the red zone, that was an incredible throw and a great catch by Shaheen, rookie to rookie. That's the kind of stuff you'd like to see. The throw to Dontrell Inman at the end of the game that set up the field goal was an incredible throw. So a lot of good things. Obviously, you can't fumble the snap. That was the worst play of the day for him. It's always hard to tell if the center is to blame for that at all. But Trubisky took the blame for it after the game, and you just can't have that. But you also saw the zone read get in there.
Yeah, we saw Mitchell Trubisky running the ball. Is that something that we knew about coming out of college? And does he have the kind of Jay Cutler speed, the hidden speed that we should know about?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about his athleticism, and he's not necessarily a guy you want. He's not Cam Newton. You don't want him running all the time, but he has the ability to run. You saw it multiple times, whether it was on design runs or when he scrambled at the end of the game on 4th and 13. He can make people miss. One of those runs wasn't even a zone read. If you might remember the specific play, he snapped it and looked straight at the unblocked end, which by design, he was unblocked. Now, I don't know if he had another option on that play, but it was basically a play that was designed to leave him one-on-one and make that guy miss. And if he made him miss, he had a big running lane, and it worked. He made the guy miss, and he took off. Now, what that does is it sets up the threat of the quarterback keeping the ball. And on Jordan Howard's touchdown run, if you watch closely, the linebackers froze because they had to make sure that Trubisky wasn't going to keep the ball. He handed it off. Howard had a lane up the middle, and he scored. So
see how it all comes together, right?
Right. So we saw both with Tariq Cohen just on the field, that threat, and then the threat of Trubisky running. These are two things that, man, we've been talking about it for weeks. Right. How do you not get it in the offense? Once they do, it makes it a lot harder to play defense against this Bears offense, and they were able to do some good things off of it.
Let's bring in Craig. Craig, you're not a Mitchell Trubisky fan, I take it.
No, because the way I see him play is like deer in the headlights. I mean, some of those plays I was watching yesterday, especially that fourth quarter drive where he did like his pirouette dance, and he made the play, but it's like desperation.
Yeah.
What happened to
well,
Mark
because
Sanchez?
he was running for his life.
Yeah, really, I know. Seems like what happened to Mark Sanchez? Because it seems like the players gave up on this guy. Like they want the rookie to look bad.
Thanks,
what
Craig.
What happened to Mark Sanchez? Why don't we play him?
We'll see. All right. Thanks, Craig. Thanks for that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that there's a chance unless there's an injury that Mark Sanchez sees the field. But what about that? I mean, is the team rallying behind Mitchell Trubisky? Is he a true leader for the squad?
Yeah, I think they love him. I think that was kind of just a completely inaccurate read of the situation there. Josh Sitton, who I just mentioned, he was raving about Trubisky too today. I mean, he has earned the respect from those guys in the huddle. Sitton told a great story to the Green Bay media a couple weeks ago when he had a teleconference before the Packer game, talking about a time in practice early on where they broke the huddle. The offensive line broke the huddle too soon, and Trubisky yelled at them and said, "Hey, get back here." And there was a couple words I can't say on the radio right now that were in there as well. And Sitton said, I love that. And right there, you know, that was a moment where they really believed in what Trubisky's saying. And Sitton talked about this today too. You can't just relay the play. A lot of it's body language. And you know, we talked about this with Jay Cutler for a long time. I thought it was actually talked about too much. But there's something to be said for going into the huddle as a quarterback with confidence.
Right.
Because when the players hear the quarterback have confidence in a play that's about to be run, they believe in it. And right now, every indication I get from guys that are bringing this stuff up voluntarily, it's not like we're asking for it. They're bringing it up voluntarily on their own and raving about Trubisky's ability to do that in the huddle. I think there's way more positives than negatives right now. And if I'm a Bears fan, I would be really excited about the future of Mitch Trubisky right now.
You know, back to the point we made with the rookies, right? Not playing in the two-minute drill. And this kind of gets me because John Fox's philosophy, and it's one that we've seen through coaching, and OB was talking about this as well today on Roe. He was talking about the idea that, yeah, sure, they can run the ball. And they can run the ball well. But it's a passing league. It's moved on from coaches like John Fox.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing being that John Fox seems to coach to a close game. And I don't know if that's possible to do, but it doesn't seem like the Bears are out there with an aggressive edge trying to, you know, get up 21 points. They seem comfortable, and we've seen this in all of Mitchell Trubisky's starts, essentially, having the ball or close to having the ball to have the game on the line at the end. So it seems to me, why would you have personnel issues if that is your philosophy? If your philosophy is to go there, wouldn't you train up people in the two-minute warning before you train them up in or the two-minute drill as opposed to, you know, what to do in the second quarter? You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't seem to – they don't seem – the chemistry's off in the idea that this is how the Bears play, yet they're not getting the right people in the right place.
Well, my podcast partner, Adam Johns, has talked about this a lot this season and John Fox's influence on the offense. And there's no question he does have a significant influence on the offense. And I think what we're seeing is an old school head coach that doesn't necessarily trust his rookies to do a whole lot, to put a whole lot on their plate. And that's a problem when your rookies are, in many cases this year, your best players. You know, they didn't want to play Trubisky until they absolutely had to. They didn't really want to give Adam Shaheen a whole lot of responsibility until they absolutely had to. And even though Tariq Cohen proved week one that he can make some dynamic plays, if you remember that last drive, which, in fairness, they did get down to the end zone and Jordan Howard dropped the ball at the end that would have beaten the Falcons. But Tariq Cohen wasn't on the field for that drive either because it was a two-minute package. So this goes back to week one. Now, you said earlier, it's week 11. How has that not been resolved, or has that not put on his plate at all? It is confusing, and I agree with you. But I think there's many, many situations here where you can question how much John Fox is, and you said, you know, talk about this passing league, and in some ways I think the league has passed him by. You know, we had those same conversations with Lovie Smith his last year.
Yeah.
And I think there's a reason why Lovie Smith's not in the NFL anymore.
That style of bend, not break, keep it close, have your defense be faster than the offense, that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, things have changed, and I think back to Mitch Trubisky's first preseason game, remember all the way back in August when he looked unbelievable? Now, a lot of people talk about he was going up against third stringers. That's completely fair. I would also say he had third stringers on his side of the ball, but what they didn't do in that game was really scheme. You don't really scheme in your first preseason game. You don't really, you don't say, no matter what you do, make sure you hit your check downs and don't turn the ball over. In that game, they said, just go play. Let's see what we have.
Let's see what we have.
And he looked unbelievable. They just let him play. And in moments where they just let Trubisky go out there and play, he has looked impressive. So if this continues, if things get ugly in Philadelphia, I honestly think the Bears need to look at the last 5 weeks of the season and the last five games against winnable opponents and maybe say, hey, is John Fox holding back Mitch Trubisky's development right now? If that's the case, then maybe you think about a change before the season's even over.
Wow. Adam Hogue, WGN Radio, covers the Bears. It's a Monday evening quarterback. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. Get an update on tonight's news with Rob. We'll come back and we'll talk about the defensive side of the ball. And, of course, Leonard Floyd. Stay with us.
13-yard gain here on fourth down. And right now, not looking good. Trubisky's going to run it. And he is going to get a first down. How about Trubisky to the 42-yard line? Oh my goodness.
Plays like that that keep us excited about Bears football in a couple of years. 312-981-7200. Adam Hogue on the line. It's the Monday evening quarterback. 312-981-7200. Text, I'll get to them in just a second. It's also people on the line. Adam Hogue, of course, covers the Bears for WGN Radio. You can find it all at WGNradio.com/Bears. And, of course, all over the radio as well. All right, so let's talk about the defensive side of the ball. A game in which, I mean, if you look at the stats, not that bad in the sense that they didn't give up too many points to an offense that can put up a lot of points. Under 70 yards rushing. The Bears defense did well, but once again, and we talked about this the week before, when they needed to stop, they didn't get it.
Yeah, that's true, and it's been a few games now where that's happened. But, you know, I thought that they made good halftime adjustments. The second quarter was really the worst quarter defensively. Matthew Stafford just looked unbelievable, carving up the Bears' secondary. Vic Fangio maybe panicked a little bit with Kyle Fuller's tackling issues, took him out, put Marcus Cooper in. That was a disaster.
Yeah, right.
Then one point actually had Amukamara out of the game too, and that ended there, and they stuck with Amukamara and Fuller in the second half, and that helped. Because, man, Marcus Cooper.
What happened?
He looked like
him?
A guy who hadn't played in a long time.
Well, 773 is the same question. Marcus Cooper is somebody who at the beginning of the year, we were talking about a good free agent acquisition. This is a guy who's going to hold that corner down. We were thinking he might even have Kyle Fuller be cut in training camp. But he got hurt a little bit. He obviously made zero fans with his run back of the field goal, the blocked field goal against Pittsburgh and not finishing. But he's not looked like a good cornerback, and yesterday he was exposed. I mean, it looked like every single time there was a wide-open guy, Marcus Cooper, number 31, was not too far behind.
Well, the reason he got bumped out had more to do with injury than anything else, and Fuller started playing well. So that opened up opportunity up for Fuller, and he took advantage of it, but Cooper wasn't playing great. Yesterday he gets back in there and just looked terrible. So That I think is getting added to a long list of free agency signings from this offseason that were just, they don't look that good. Amukamara is the one that looks pretty good, but I mean, if you just think about what you're getting out of Mike Glennon, disaster, Marcus Wheaton doing absolutely nothing, Marcus Cooper doesn't look good, Deion Sims has been fine, but nothing, you know, too amazing, and now he has this mysterious illness, so he's not even out there. I mean, it is just not really a good free agency class for the Bears. I don't know how much that really ends up mattering. This league, you build through the draft, and as long as Ryan Pace is drafting well, he can get away with some of these misses, as long as he also gets hits like Danny Trevathan and Akeem Hicks, who have really worked out.
Right.
But, Cooper just doesn't look good. But to get back to your question about the defense, so they made adjustments. Second half played a lot better, but you're right. They weren't able to get that fourth quarter stop, and honestly, that holding penalty on T.J. Lang ended up stalling that drive, and Prater picked him up with that field goal, but that one could have been a lot worse, although give Akeem Hicks credit. He was playing hurt at that point in the fourth quarter, and he is still playing at such a powerful high level that he just overpowered T.J. Lang on that play and drew the hold. It ended up being a crucial play in that game, giving the Bears a chance to tie. Unfortunately, they just couldn't take advantage of it.
Well, let's talk about the injuries. Akeem Hicks came out for a little bit, but we got to talk about Leonard Floyd. Just the kind of thing that you see every single week in the NFL now, where a knee goes the wrong way. The cart comes out on the field. We assume the worst. Today, Coach John Fox at least mentions that they don't think it's an ACL. I don't know how much we even trust the John Fox press conference for actual information at this point. But Leonard Floyd out for the season, but it could have been worse.
Well, for those scoring at home, it took four questions, an original question, and three follow-ups for John Fox to even finally admit that it wasn't a torn ACL. He was really trying as hard as he could not to say that, but he did it. But it still sounds like a significant knee injury, because he also mentioned the fact that there's a couple different doctors involved. It sounds like Leonard Floyd's going to get a second opinion. So just because the ACL is intact doesn't mean that there's not other significant damage in there. Obviously, the ACL is the big one. And at a minimum, you're hopeful that this doesn't disrupt Leonard Floyd's offseason too much. You suffer an ACL here, and you're talking about lucky to be back for training camp, right? And hopefully you're able to go by week one next year. So if they can at least avoid that, it could be something as little as just the MCL, and maybe he plays again this season. I don't know, but there's six games left. Even if Floyd misses the rest of the season, though, this is a big it's good news, because at this point, the playoffs are out of the picture. This year, this season's pretty much over, and you were just worried about 2018 at that point with a catastrophic-type knee injury, and it doesn't sound like it's that. So that was good news today. Now the question is, what do the Bears do from here without Leonard Floyd? And
yeah, right.
They're running out of options here. You know, who would have thought Pernell McPhee is the one outside linebacker that lasted this
long? Can I ask a question, though, Adam? And I think all Bears fans want to know this, because we talked about this last year. There were so many injuries and so many key players on the Bears. I mean, is that just the NFL today? I mean, are the New England Patriots and the Dallas Cowboys and the Philadelphia Eagles, are they all having the same issues where they're on their third outside linebacker and their second safety and their fourth offensive guard? Like, is it an anomaly for us, or is it just the way the NFL is now?
Well, it seems like it's hurt this team a lot more over the course of three consecutive seasons. Really bad last year, still pretty bad this year. You know, it's hitting most teams hard. Maybe the Bears are still on the more extreme end of this, but there's plenty of other teams going through this too. You know, if you've actually taken the list of players who are out this year for the season, it's an all-pro team. I mean, it is Aaron Rodgers, J.J. Watt-type players all across the board. You know, most of the Seattle
Richard Sherman,
secondary is out. It's crazy. It's crazy. So it's an epidemic. Now, I'll say in this case with Leonard Floyd, I don't think Kyle Fuller did anything wrong, but I do think it's somewhat of a byproduct of, with all this emphasis on head injuries, you're seeing a lot more players flying in low, right? And you come in a little bit out of control, and that can lead to more injuries, whether to yourself or to a teammate or an opponent. It just
We've
seems
seen
like
that,
it's
you know,
happening.
I've picked that up, Adam. I picked up the Kyle Fuller tackle when he comes in like a torpedo. And he's been doing it the last couple of weeks, and he's had success on it, where he's had some open field tackles where you're like, whoa, he put a wallop on a running back or a receiver out there. But he does do that. He comes in barreling, and you saw in this case he missed his guy, and he hit Leonard Floyd.
And he's missed an earlier tackle in the game too, because when you come in kind of that fast and out of control, you're going to miss sometimes. But he's also not a huge guy, so, you know, breaking down an opponent on a tackle isn't always his best option, because it leaves him open to a stiff arm or something like that when he's trying to tackle a bigger player. So I get it. And then you're also worried about the head injuries and flying in with your head and hitting another guy helmet to helmet. It's a problem, not just in the NFL, but in college football with all these targeting calls we see every week too.
Right.
And I've seen plenty of them with Northwestern this year. I think the Cats are up to five on the season. So it's just happening in football. It's the game these days and how it has changed.
All right, so let's talk about what they do. I mean, is Sam Acho now a starting outside linebacker? Obviously, Nick Kukowski and Kristen Jones are in the middle. I mean, is Trevathan coming back this season? Is he out for good? Like, there's so many questions about the front seven, especially the linebacking crew for this team.
Yeah, because, I mean, with Pernell McPhee, you kind of know he's not going to give you a full game. He tends to show up a little bit more in the second half. I don't know if that's by design or you know, just the way he's at in his career right now, but it's good, because he's been making plays in the third and fourth quarter, not so much in the first half. But you're running out of bodies here, where, you know, Isaiah Irving's a young undrafted rookie who's going to be playing more, but here's probably the most significant possible development. If Danny Trevathan can come back, Nick Kwiatkowski's playing at a high level right now. He needs to stay on the field. So then the question is, what do you do with Christian Jones? Mm. Well, Christian Jones has moved from inside and outside linebacker a few times. So I would suggest, and maybe even you do that even if Trevathan's not ready for next week, because you do have John Timu who plays and plays okay. So I think that's something the Bears may consider because they're running out of bodies. Sam Acho is just not a pass rusher. He's a solid, strong side linebacker who's good against the run, but he's not really going to pile up sacks. I'm not sure Isaiah Irvin and Christian Jones are going to do that either. But like I said, you're running out of bodies, and I just don't know what else the Bears are going to do. Missing Floyd is, it kills you. He's been playing much better than his numbers show. And again, it's just fortunate that this doesn't sound like it's a catastrophic knee injury.
Adam Hoge, WGN Radio. He covers us both the Bears for the radio, but also for the site. You can find it at WGNradio.com/Bears. We're talking the future of the team. I'm fascinated at the 3-7, which it made me even tonight before we talked go and find out what their record was at this point last year. They were 2-8.
Yeah.
One game improvement. Of course, the rookie quarterback may have something to do with that in development. But is this team, and I ask you this every week, but to be only one game better at 3-7 and essentially out of the playoffs, that's not good enough for Chicago Bears fans. I mean, is this how can we be okay with a team that went from 3-13 to 3-7 and there isn't this significant improvement?
You can't be okay with it, and I don't blame fans who are frustrated. It's got to be frustrating when you see. Here's the thing that I think has bothered me the most this year, just covering this team. I said this last week a little bit too. The excuses about not having the talent, to me, are just going out the window more and more every week. I mean, just look at what we talked about earlier this hour with the play of Tariq Cohen, who's a rookie. The play of Mitch Trubisky, who's a rookie. Mm-hmm. The play of Adam Shaheen, who I think is not getting enough attention right now. He not only is getting involved in the passing game and should probably be getting even more opportunities, but he's also blocking very well, and that was the question about him. He had a great game yesterday blocking in the run game. He needs to be your number one tight end right now. I don't care what's going on with Deion Sims' illness. I don't care if Daniel Brown can be out there. Adam Shaheen is this up-and-coming rookie. He needs to play, and it's like John Fox has a problem playing these rookies. I don't know how else to explain it because there's no reason why they shouldn't be out there. So if you're a fan out there, I understand the frustration. And it's mind-boggling because you have a pretty good defense, and at this point they're getting banged up to the point where it's like you feel like you wasted the season. Right? The defense was playing lights out a few weeks ago. Now they're still holding their own, and despite all the injuries, and Akeem Hicks is out there banged up, and he's playing through all of it. Kyle Long on the other side of the ball has got 7 different injuries. Mm-hmm. Every limb in his body's hurt, and he's playing through it. And they're still finding ways to lose the game at the end, and a lot of it appears to be on the coaching staff.
Personnel, choices, when to challenge, when not.
Not letting these rookies play. They're your best players. Let them go. I don't know. I've been covering this team for 7 years, and for the 7th straight season, I will not be covering a playoff game this year.
It's demoralizing.
That's sad.
It is sad, and it's demoralizing because, you know, we've been taught as Bears fans from the ownership, but also from the coaches, especially the strong ones we've had, that the key to winning. I mean, I'll always love what Lovie Smith came in and says. We will beat the Packers. We will win our division. Those are the games that matter to us. That's almost football 101. And here we are with John Fox, where you're losing at home to the Detroit Lions. You're losing at home to was that the home game against Minnesota? They're losing at home last week to Green Bay. They're 0-4 in the NFC North. And to act as if this is the best division in football is a joke. They're not the best football. Detroit is not that great. Green Bay has a backup quarterback that got blanked by the Ravens, who we beat. And yes, the Minnesota Vikings are having an okay year. They're going to be a playoff team that gets beat in the first round, as they always do. It blows my mind that we're even having. I mean, I would think that you'd want a general manager or an owner or a McCaskey in his fur coat or somebody to rock out and be like, it is unacceptable to be 0-4 in the NFC North come November. It's just unacceptable.
Well, George McCaskey's hanging out in the South lot with all the fans who are happy, according to him. Remember that at the end of last season when he said
that?
Yeah, sure they are. 10,000 no-shows yesterday, by the way. Which is alarming. Hey, John Fox is 3-13 against the NFC North. 3-13. That's
how
a full
that?
Season.
No, all right, he's gone.
That's a that alone is a fireable offense. I go back. You know, a lot of people told me that I put too much stock in last week's game against the Packers.
No,
but you saw the start. Had they gone up 10-0 like they did yesterday? If they had gone up 10-0 on the Packers, they would have won that game easily.
Hunley's not bringing him back,
Because Hundley's not coming back, and you saw the real Brett Hundley yesterday. They lose 23-0 to a team the Bears beat earlier this season, and now the Packers are 13.5-point underdog next week against another team you beat earlier this year, the Pittsburgh Steelers. So these are teams the Bears have already beaten, and the Packers are that big of, you know, getting shut out and then a huge underdog next week, and that's the team that came into Soldier Field, your biggest rival, and you played awful against them. And I said it last week, we talked about it, John Fox completely flopped in that game. At this point, between that and the divisional record and the things we're still talking about, I don't see how he keeps his job at the end of the year.
Yeah, he can't. I don't even know what to say because then I ask about the GM because I was just looking at this and I've got it close, but I'm not sure if I got the numbers right. But, you know, the time between Wanstead and Geron, there was a time there when we got real bad. I mean, we're talking Curtis Conway bad, where it was 19, maybe after the playoffs in 96 or 97, and we didn't see another playoff game till maybe 02 or 01 when they had that Geron year. And then Lovie Smith had a couple of, you know, sporadic playoff appearances. But, I mean, to say we have not been in a playoff game since 2011, right? To say we're coming up on seven seasons here, six seasons. And it's the longest drought in modern Bears history. And I know as a fan, I don't want to rebuild again. We got John Fox to rebuild off of Trestman. I don't want to go through another 3-4-12 seasons, 3-13. I don't want to do that anymore. But the writing is on the wall. I mean, we are in a very, very terrible era for Chicago Bears football.
There's no question about it. It's just been a tough run, and I think comparing it to the late 90s is completely fair because that was, you know, the most recent time period where it got this ugly. I will say that the thing that's separating the Bears from, say, the Browns, and you can argue that those are the two worst franchises in the NFL right now, is I still look at this young talent that has been brought in under Ryan Pace and say that there's something to build on. I don't think you need to rebuild completely. I don't think you need to get rid of him and shut it all down and start from scratch, and I don't think that's going to happen. I think they just need to find a better coach to coach up this young talent that they have, specifically Mitch Trubisky. That's the number one priority.
Right.
But it's not like Ryan Pace is without blame. I brought up the free agency signings. They're not good this year. The draft was good. The draft was really good, it looks like, and that's what you build off of. But, you know, there's more misses than hits in free agency right now, even though the hits seem to be pretty good. And he deserves some of the blame for Connor Barth. And if I'm a player and I look at what happened yesterday and you played that much better and you got things going offensively and it came down to a kicker that they've known all year is not good. They paid Roberto Aguayo almost half a million dollars to be there for 3 weeks in training camp and say bye-bye because they knew Connor Barth wasn't good. And he's still on the team in week 11 and misses a kick. That is unacceptable. Unacceptable. And a lot of that was on John Fox. John Fox was the one that wanted to make the change from Robbie Gould to Connor Barth after Gould missed a couple of kicks the year before and cost him a game or two. But you're still the GM, and you're in charge of the roster at the end of the day. And even if you were okay with Fox saying, all right, let's go get Barth, and you made that move, that was a long time ago. You should have found another solution in this offseason, and you didn't, and it cost you a huge game yesterday.
Especially if your philosophy is to win at the end. I mean, if you're going to play close games and you're going to be close, don't you need a really kick-ass special teams?
It just seems you got to have a good kicker.
And a good kicker and a good punter and a good cover team and a good kick returner. We have seen all of that devalued in this team with Ryan Pace and John Fox. I mean, I think it was last year that they just had guys back there to fair catch. I mean, it's funny to see Dave Taub coaching. I didn't even recognize that he's coaching the Kansas City Chiefs special teams.
Yeah.
And you watch the Chiefs, and it's like, bam, There they go, they're Devin Hester style. Great. Well, they're great, where you're like, oh, my God, these guys. And I just wonder if this is just the way that this coach and this GM, they just don't value it in a way that, that it's been valued before in this town.
Yeah, but I will say I do think that Ryan Pace has a lot of things in the right direction here. This is completely different than Phil Emery. And how bad it got in year number three. Just think about that, because the both of these GMs, it's third 3 years, okay? Just look at how much different things are with Ryan Pace in year three than they were with Phil Emery. Now, you can actually say that Phil Emery won more games, but you got to look at the roster construction and really look at how bad they were. That was a roster to go in the wrong direction. This, I think, is a roster that's ascending, and that's at least a good sign.
Well, Adam, this went south. You know, I got... I feel like I got more depressed than I wanted to in this conversation. But, you know, big game to at least see. I the Bears have had only two really poor games, one against the Packers early on and one against Tampa, which is an anomaly at this point. But those were both Mike Glennon games. Let's see if Mitchell Trubisky can hang with a team that is one of the elite, if not the best, in the NFC.
Here's the funny thing. I mean, this is a 12-point line. We knew it was going to be high when you think about how good the Eagles are, and the Bears are coming off on a three-game losing streak now. But I wouldn't be surprised if the Bears play the Eagles close. Yeah. They've done this all season. The defense is still pretty good. Losing Floyd's going to hurt, but Trubisky has shown he's not going to turn the ball over a whole lot, and that's going to keep them in game. So I don't think they win. I don't think they really – I'm not even sure they'll have a chance to miss a field goal at the end. I don't know if it's that close, but I would be surprised if they get blown out by the Eagles on Sunday. I think they'll be in the game, you know, for a good portion of it. And not to be too depressing, but let me just leave you with this thought. Many people don't even know that Mark Trestman is now coaching the Toronto Argonauts in the Canadian Football League. He has advanced to the Grey Cup, which is the equivalent of the Super Bowl. He will be playing for that on Sunday afternoon. So if you get a chance after the Bears lose to the Eagles, you'll have the opportunity to turn on the Grey Cup and watch Mark Trestman potentially win the CFL.
Well, we'll do it at Martyr's house. How about that? Adam Hoge, WGN Radio. He covers the Bears for us here, and you can find out all his great stuff, his writings, and also his podcasts at WGNRadio.com/Bears. And joins us every Monday for the Monday Evening Quarterback. Adam, thanks for joining us, bud.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It is the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later in the hour, it's Industry Night. Deb Perlman will be here from Smitten Kitchen. She's got a great food blog and a new cookbook. We'll talk with her about her amazing career. The new book is really about how to – she lives in the East Village in New York City. Not a big deal. I'm a New York guy. And she is essentially – her whole life is around cooking in very small spaces. And that's what just her kitchens and the apartment she's had and her time in New York City have forced her to cook in a certain way. And she talks about that in her book. So we'll have Deb Perlman coming up here in the 9:30 hour. And in Studio 435 tonight, the Safes, garage rock band from Chicago, playing Beat Kitchen on Wednesday night. They are here tonight for return engagement, Studio 435, setting up as we speak. Well, tonight, let's talk literature and literacy. The Chicago After School Arts and Humanities Program, Cool Classics, just received the 2017 National Arts and Humanities Youth Program Award, the highest honor bestowed upon the after-school programs, just like this one. Cool Classics is a simple concept, bringing literature and arts and culture to Chicago schools. Simple, but the overall concept is one that we can all understand. The more literature and the ideas presented by said literature that a student is exposed to, the more likely they're better to understand the world around us or be able to make better decisions or even do better in school. And you could say, well, isn't that what school is for? But in most cases, due to budget cutbacks and more politically correct commercial culture, what's being offered to students leaves much to be desired. Cool Classics is the brainchild of teacher and award-winning journalist Mara Tapp. Tapp is a familiar name to Chicago radio listeners. She hosted the Mara Tapp Show on public radio. She also shows about literature and ideas for WYCC, WFMT. She taught at Columbia College, School of the Art Institute, and we used to work together. Mara Tapp, welcome to the download. Good to see you.
You too.
It's been a long time.
Long time. We were all younger then.
Mary, one of our great listeners, texted in. She said, oh, I love Mara Tapp. I'm so, oh my God, what a great time. She was best show ever. And you had a show on public radio here in Chicago for a decade in the 90s, and a little mop-haired kid named Justin sat behind the show and watched you guys work.
Radio hair in those days, right?
Well, it's great to see you. And you know, Cool Classics, congratulations on the award. Talk about the, I mean, the last we worked together, you were a journalist, you're a talk show host, you were working, I knew you were working on a freelance project. What took you down the path of Cool Classics?
Accident. Happenstance, serendipity, all that good stuff. So when I left WBEZ, I actually went to Racine, Wisconsin to try and restart a show called Conversations from Wingspread, which John Calloway, the amazing late great, had hosted, won a Peabody for. And, you know, we did that for a while, and happy with a syndication offer offered by FMT, but the boss wasn't happy. So we said, okay, fine, we're going to come back to Chicago now. And I had one day a week free. I am the very proud parent of two very proud Chicago Public School graduates. My daughters loved CPS. And I thought, well, you know, my daughters are teenagers. You aren't there yet, but you will be. It would be really nice to be with some small children. So I thought a couple friends of mine subbed in Chicago Public Schools. I decided to give it a try. Loved it. Went to the school they started at, a great school, Walt Disney Magnet School, and discovered that in the 10 years since they'd been in elementary school, so much had left, even at a wonderful school like that.
Really?
So, because the press was on, the fill-in-the-bubble mentality, the drill and kill, there are all kinds of nicknames for it. And although they were in much better shape there, they weren't reading the classic books, either because the new younger teachers hadn't been taught them, or they weren't in the textbooks. You said politically correct, whatever.
Right.
Left knocks right out, and pretty soon you got the back
of
the cereal box.
It's so true. I mean, there's almost like you can go Google what books are ready for fifth graders, sixth graders, seventh graders. But what you're talking about is exposing kids to literature that aren't on those lists. And we're not talking about expansive, controversial topics. You're talking about great stories that really give this idea, these morals, these fables, things that are going to make people understand the
with
world
moral
around.
Complexity,
right?
Okay, and putting a modern read on them, fine. I'm laughing because we're doing the story of Ferdinand at the school we've been at the longest, and I asked for a plot summary today. We're about 3 or 4 weeks.
So you asked the kids,
yeah, and they're first through third here. And one of my ambassadors, we call children who return to us ambassadors because they're part of the country that we build. And asked for a plot summary. He said, "Well, you know, Ferdinand wasn't very active." He sat around all the time smelling the flowers. So he got stung by the bee. And I'm thinking, well, there's a new one on Ferdinand. But you got to love it. Not active.
Yeah, I mean, but there's probably, I would say, for first and third graders, or even myself or people I know or my family, I mean, there's a certain level where you don't ever get exposed to these books unless you go try it yourself. And it's very difficult to do because, like I said, there's so much at the school level that's being offered.
And the teachers are under such pressure.
Right.
And this program is meant in no way to diss teachers, because I am a huge admirer of teachers. It is as hard to run a classroom of 20 to 30 children as it is to run a radio show. And in fact, the skills are quite similar, I discovered. Yes, because you're all about keeping it moving, control, next question, what are we doing? Did he earn the smart pin? Nope, give it to her, you know, whatever. But anyway, I started subbing one day a week, and pretty soon the Disney principal said, oh, I really need you here every day. And I said, nope, sorry, no. But I started to bring in books that had been mine, my daughter's, my father's. My mother only had two books, so I brought those in too. And I discovered the children loved them. And I started to bring in what I call classic books. So Ferdinand is a better-known one, but everybody knows Shrek. The worst book by William Steig ever. So we do The Amazing Bone, which is about the power of language, imagination, and friendship. And it rocks, you know? You got a bone that talks, does magical spells, and is smart and can make noises, and the kids love it. So what I started doing was coming up with these on-the-spot ideas. And then I ran into a man who was a former student of my husband's, was working for Kellogg as a program director, and he asked me my opinion about CPS. And I was responded that way. And then he asked me what I would do to fix it. And we sat down at a Formica table at a Korean restaurant and began Cool Classics. Piloted it. They were very generous in their grant. And they said, now, good, you have a year. We're buying your brain. Make it fly. And so we have been going along ever since. Now, I will tell you, when I started it, you know, there's a wall in journalism, as you know.
Right.
We don't talk to funders, right?
Right.
So I didn't really know any. But I had two who were sources of mine. And they both said, you're nuts. And I said, why? They said, this is the worst possible time in the world to start something like this. And I said, is there a need? And they said yes. I said, well, then I worked for public radio for 20 years. You know, you I'm certifiable. So off we went. And then there were the closings. And then there were the changes in the bus schedules and the longer school day. And we have really been buffeted by the politics of this country right now, in this time we're in, this city, the state, and our attitudes towards education. But here's the amazing part. What I discovered, for me, it was confirmation of what I knew, that my children are as natively brilliant as anywhere. What they lack are the resources, and what they face are more obstacles. So our job, resources, take away the obstacles.
You know, I always wonder, because, you know, there's not only this push for under resources, but there's also this pushback against culture. And this idea that, you know, well, we don't need Ferdinand. We you know what? This is, I hate this. I hate that you're putting this down, they're shoving this down our throats. We just want we want to watch our Monday Night Football, whatever it is, right? But do you know, I mean, do you notice that? Do you notice like a push and pull when it comes to the culture of
classics?
But
not with our children. Because
they don't know anything else.
No, that's not why. Because I grab them at age of reading. And that varies because we understand that we don't really have equal resources in all our schools. So at one school, it might be K. At one school, it might be first. We go K through 3, and we let the schools pick our students. And we want diversity. It's Chicago, so we usually can't do that racially and ethnically, but we can do it in terms of gender, grade, and ability. Mm-hmm. So we bring in children, and we want to teach them, first of all, to love books. Secondly, to love ideas and to be able to think. And we do that in a number of ways. Last year, at the end of the year, one of my students raised their hand. We listen a lot to students. I love to talk a lot, but I love to listen even more. So one of our students raised his hand and said, why are we in Cool Classics? I said, I love that question. That is a great question. Why don't you tell me what you think the answer is? And he said, because we have so much fun. I'm like, I love that answer. Now do you want me to tell you why I think you're here? And they're like, yeah. I said, okay. So we want you to be able to think really deeply about everything, ideas, art. We want you to be able to know all about all the arts because we bring those in. So we do music. We do everything from Steve Martin's King Tut with one book to Mozart with another. So we're all over the place. We want you to know visual arts. Picasso. Today we looked at Picasso's bulls, all different ones he painted. We want you to know dance. We learn a little bit of East Indian dance, Bharatanatyam. We do everything. So I said, I want you to know all the arts so that you can. And we do a lot of call and recall so they answer back, because by the end of the day, they know, go out and make the world a better place. I'm like, that's right. Sometimes I ask them, could you grow up a little faster, please?
Mara Tapp, my guest, she is the founder and creator of Cool Classics, which is an after-school arts and humanities program, which just received one of the 2017 National Arts and Humanities Youth Program Awards, the highest honor. You know, and did you think, I know you and I've known you and I haven't seen you in so long, and it's such a pleasure to hear your voice, and it's a pleasure to catch up with you. But did, now that you've been doing this and you get the award and you're moving in a direction where you're actually having this impact on children's lives, is this your calling? I mean, is this where you're going? Because at the time you talked about saying, I just want to get closer to, you know, I want to sub once in a while. I mean, have you completely made the transition?
Yes.
This is what you do?
I mean, I'm the 14-hour days I used to do at BEZ, I now do for Cool Classics. But I want to circle back to that, to the high culture, intellectual thing, because here's what I'm finding. And Cool Classics has been surprising. I started out with one book, and now we have 6 different curricula. And we build this world of art around it. But here's a great example of how children who think they don't like classical music do. So with one book, it's by Don Freeman, who did Corduroy. Everybody knows Corduroy. Sweet story, simple story. Too simple for me. We don't do that one. So we do 2 others that are more complex. So for the one that involves the magic flute, we look at all these different versions of it. We analyze them using the 3 pieces that are referenced in the book, which are very famous. There's the Queen of the Night aria. We don't sing because I tell them, you're not trained to sing opera. We'll follow it with our fingers. We really want children to hear music, to learn how to listen to it. We tell them we have a music listening position. Let the music tell your body how it should move. So we do Queen of the Night. We learned, amazingly, that Mozart is an excellent artist to teach nonviolence. Who would have guessed? So we're in one school. Yeah, I mean, this one surprised the bejeegers out of me. We're in one school, very tough neighborhood. It was the year Janila Watkins was killed, the baby, right after Hadiya Pendleton. Right. Her parents had gone to that school. Her cousins were there. Our performance was the day after that baby was shot. We didn't know she was dead yet. The police had showed up that morning, code of silence, down to kindergarten. We come in for our performance, and our children are following the voice of this fancy soprano up to the roof and jumping, and then when it's over, they all lie down on the floor and say to a packed library, "We're dead, we're killed." And I look at my lead teacher like, "Where did this come from?" And we don't know. The next time we come in, I say, you know, she says, "Well, why did you do that?" They said, "We wanted you to know we were good actors." So at first I'm beating myself up, and then I realize, no, this is good, because these children had a place they could come to talk about and express their anger, their fear, their despair. And later that day, we had a couple of fourth graders. Technically, we take third graders, but it just so happens sometimes they won't go away at the end of the program. They're doing an art project, and I walk by the table, and one says to the other, "So what would happen if a bullet went through your body at 40 miles an hour?" And I'm like, "Excuse me, I think we're doing an art project here. What's going on?" And I realize at that time, lots of rumors are swirling around about the father. There's all kinds of ugly stuff in the paper, and I know they're hearing it. And I say, "You know, I know that you all are hearing a lot right now on the street and the news, and we don't know how it's going to sort out. We just don't know. It's too early. But here is one thing that I do know, and this is the most important thing. No baby deserves to die, ever. So that's what you need to hold on to." So we found it fabulous. You know, we've had children, when the queen hands the knife to her daughter and says, "Go kill someone," we stop the film. We say to our children, "Is that the right thing?"
Right.
And they're like, "No." Or occasionally.
But just having the opportunity in any school setting, especially schools that are under-resourced, to have those conversations. Because I would assume that under-resourced also means, you know, not being able to fully comprehend the world that's happening around them.
Not having a library, having no books in a library, not having a music teacher, not having an art teacher. One of my colleagues said to me once, "There are days I just put my head down on the desk and cry." I said, "You know what, we all have those days, but keep me on speed dial. Next time it happens, call me, we'll cry together." The reality is the resilience of my children through all of this. So they come up with stuff. Like one child, we take Mozart on our field trips with us. We go on field trips. We have a lending library. We do all kinds of stuff. But we take him on field trips because we perform these elements and we do a final performance. And so one day, one of our assistant principals is along, and he knew what we were doing, but he's like, "Why does Ms. Tapp make her hands go like this? What is all that about?" And he says, and he's a very challenging third grader. He says, "Well, this is Papageno, and this is Papagena, and he's a foolish bird catcher. She's his yuck girlfriend. Really disgusting. Ms. Tapp makes us make them kiss at the end, which is revolting." And he goes, "But I really can't get that song out of my head." I'm like, "Score!
Score! You know, score for Mara. That's great."
So, but the fact is that they love it because, you know what? It's good stuff. Yeah. And we're not saying only listen to Mozart. Like tonight on the drive down, I'm like, "I really could use some Mozart." No, it was Dvorak. Bing, let's go to Motown. Bing, not good. Let's go to gospel. You want to be able to experience it all in its totality. We want these children to feel like they own this world.
Mara Tapp, the founder, creator of Cool Classics, the after-school arts and humanities program, just got one of the 2017 National Arts and Humanities Youth Program Award, and continues to do work in Chicago schools. Former talk show host, continued journalist. I mean, this is your byline once in a while, right?
I do, and I'm actually going to do an interview for the American Writers Museum that I'm really excited about. With the grandchildren of Madeleine L'Engle, A Wrinkle in Time, who have written a biography. So, yeah, the reality is this work is so rewarding. It's exhausting. It's infuriating sometimes, but it's so rewarding when you see a child light up and they make you laugh. And when you see a child learn, that's like, whoa, wow, that was astonishing.
Pleasure, Mara Tapp. Always a pleasure to see you. Let's not make it 20 years or whatever it's been since last time we saw each other.
Too long.
Too long. Thanks for being here. Great to have Mara Tapp on the program. I can't tell you, man. I was 19 years old sitting there, and we had this communal room. We used to have an office at the at Clark and Adams in the Bankers Building. It was up on the 39th floor. After we were done there, and moved to Navy Pier, Frank Thomas took over these studios for his record label. Pretty cool, huh? So Frank Thomas is producing people where I sat and made phone calls because we didn't have computers because it was 1994 or whatever. But Mara would have her her office was right next to me, and I remember this because the day we moved out, the ceiling of her office collapsed. Like, it collapsed because it was not a good space. Like, it was just like a leaking roof or whatever in this huge old building, you know, downtown. And I was like, I just thought that was funny. And then we sat right by each other when we moved to cubicles at Navy Pier. So I've always been an earshot of that voice, either being on the air, producing for her, directing for her, or being in a position where I was just on the other side of the cubicle where she was dressing somebody down. She came in. It was so funny. I wish I was going to say something about it, but right off the bat, she's like, "Do I not get water? Where's my water?" I'm like, "Oh man!" I'm like, it took me back to being 20 years old, being like, "I'm sorry, Miss Stapp." That was fun. Great to have her on the program. She is a treasure and awesome work that she's doing in the schools. Coming up, Deb Perlman, Industry Night. We're going to talk with her about Smitten Kitchen, her food blog, which has been around for a decade now, and has created an empire for her. Smitten Kitchen, if you follow, it's a tremendous brand, blog, recipes, but also has now moved into cookbooks. That's coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Industry Night, our weekly exploration of the world of food and hospitality. Tonight, we get smitten. Food writer and author Deb Perlman has a new cookbook called Smitten Kitchen Every Day. It's a follow-up to her New York Times best-selling The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. Deb Perlman has run the Smitten Kitchen cooking blog out of New York for about 10 years. The self-taught home cook and photographer documented her life cooking out of tiny kitchens and even tinier New York City apartments. But in the blog and her cookbooks, Deb's able to make her recipes and others and show us that a kitchen is much more than just the countertop space. Deb Perlman was recently in town, and she joins me tonight. Deb, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm a big fan of your work. And you know, you've had a long time popular, the blog Smitten Kitchen, which everyone who's into food regularly checks in. Talk about the transition you've made from being someone who writes on a daily basis on the blog to a cookbook author. And this is your second one. Talk about the transition from that to what you're doing now.
Well, when you make a mistake on a website, you can fix it right away.
Good, the edit
Good thing my books are absolutely perfect. No, the web is, you can just kind of decide what you want to do that day and do it, you know, pretty much make it happen pretty quickly. Book takes a lot more planning. It's a different kind of muscle, even though the content is similar in that it's recipes and stories and pictures. But, you know, it's sort of fun to work on things that have longer legs, more, you know, I hope the book can be around for a while. I don't. You know, the web, well, who knows?
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe it's going to go
Maybe.
Up and poof.
It might. It's still, jury's still out on that. Talk about the different approach to it. For you as a writer, for the stuff that gets in the cookbook, as opposed to the stuff that gets on the blog, is there a different process that goes into that?
You know, the process is roughly the same, but for the site, you know, I might do something like, you know, the week before Thanksgiving, I'll talk about Thanksgiving sides a lot. I can talk about stuff that's very timely in the here and now. For a book, it's not that I wouldn't have those recipes, but they may not be so tied to such a narrow scope. I prefer things what I think of like forever recipes. You know, I'd love to, the idea that the book could be opened in 5 years and the stuff would still feel relevant, you know, almost regardless of season.
With your work, and this is a testament to your voice and your following and people who follow. When you think of cookbook authors, a lot of times they're going to be established chefs, people from restaurants. You know, you love this restaurant, here's the cookbook from it. Rarely do we see rising the ranks of the bestsellers list in the New York Times people who are amateur cooks, who are like, hey, I'm going to figure this out, and we're going to figure this out together. Where do you think that comes from people that are attracted to your voice and the idea that you're not those people?
I'm kind of wondering if people got a sense I had no idea what I was doing, and they related to that, because that's how many people feel in real life. Or maybe I'm just projecting. But I mean, I never saw any of this coming. I was just like, I'll start a site and just mouth off about food and take some pictures and then say I tweaked this recipe and I didn't like this. And just, I had no idea it was going to turn into this. But maybe it resonates, this idea that, like, I'm just kind of still figuring it out. I don't have a master plan or anything.
Deb Perlman's my guest. We're talking about the book Smitten Kitchen Every Day. She, of course, is the author of smittenkitchen.com and the best-selling New York Times best-selling book, The Smitten Kitchen Cookbook. You know, one of the things you just mentioned just about tweaking recipes, and I love this about you and looking at as someone who's dabbled and tried to master food and have come nowhere close. What I love about it is the fact that you are hacking these recipes, that there'll be something from Food and Wine or there'll be something from another cookbook. And you have the fearlessness, and that's part of the name of the site, but this fearlessness to go and say, I'm going to change this, or I want to change this ingredient or change things around and see how it works. Where does that come from?
I didn't start out that way. I started out by making a recipe that was well-regarded and being unhappy with it or tweaking it. So at first I would kind of say, here's the recipe as it is, but I kind of wanted to do A, B, and C to it. I quickly realized it was much more useful for me to actually do A, B, and C to it. And from there, I just started playing around more and more. But I think of it as more of a, you know, it's a natural flow where, you know, first you want to learn from others and then you kind of get, you know, your training wheels and you start playing around. And eventually you realize that a lot of the things you think you want to make that are original, you know, they may have existed before. So why not try out the 5 best in category crumb cakes and from there come up with your hypothesis of what you would like it to be. Of course, there are other things that, you know, we'd like to believe we fully invent. But the idea of food being completely new or unheard of before, I'd rather be honest and give credit where to where things come from or what inspires me.
I mean, it is inspiration. A lot of what you read on Smitten Kitchen is the inspiration to even have the courage to change a recipe and people go along with it. It is interesting because I have where I think I fail in the kitchen, and I think I speak for a lot of people who are amateurs, is I see a lot of what's written on the page as gospel. Meaning, you know, like I'm like, it says this much, it better be this much.
Well, if it's a Smitten Kitchen recipe, it probably
Are you encouraging people to take Smitten Kitchen recipes and play with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's two ways. I think sometimes after a long day and you're tired, it's kind of nice for a recipe to take the wheel. It's sort of nice to hand the reins over and just know that if you've got this Cook's Illustrated recipe or maybe one of mine, you might start with, you know, step 1 to 10, and it will lead you where you want to go. So I think that can be really kind of relaxing, and we don't talk about that much. I think it counts. There are other times where it's like, I want to make this, but I really don't feel like doing, you know, X, Y, or Z in here. And that's when, you know, that's where it's good to feel like, you know, I would rather make this wrong than not make it at all because I don't have time to make it to the letter. And most of my tweaking is just taking things out that I felt took more time than they rewarded me with or because I didn't have an ingredient, which I think is real for most of us. Like you've the wrong kind of broccoli or the wrong, you know, shaped carrot.
Exactly,
like, what are you going to do? Go back to the store? No, you're gonna see if it works. And once you know it works, you're going to maybe want to tell your friends that it really doesn't matter if they follow the letter of the recipe.
Another big part of what you do, and it's been a big part of Smitten Kitchen for the 10 years, almost 10 years that you've been doing the blog, is the space. The tiny kitchens that come with the great places to live in New York City and Brooklyn, other places, but they're smaller just because size is a premium. And you have embraced that concept and been able to cook a lot of the stuff that we find in the books that you've put out, but also the stuff that's on the website. You've been able to cook in spaces that others would say, I can't work with this.
I mean, I think if I started with a really big kitchen and I went to a small one, I'd be pretty mad about it. Like, I would definitely be like, God, how did I ever do this? Why would anyone do this? But the truth is, though, if you ever go to a restaurant kitchen and you see the stations that the line cooks work in, they're not much bigger than their width. They might just be a small counter themselves. It's about organization. It's about planning. Just kidding. I'm terrible at organizing and planning.
I was gonna ask
you. But I also don't put out 100 meals a night like a line cook might. But I'm just saying that, you know, in the history of time and grandmother's cooking, most of us didn't have big kitchens. They're a relatively recent development, and we always got it done. So it really just means that I'm basically just working on one thing at a time, just single tasking. And honestly, I'm not particularly good at multitasking. I can, so it sort of works for me.
I wonder if there's something about focus as well. If you're working on one thing at a time, that you get that right, or you put all your focus and love and heart and soul into that one thing and move on, and at the end of the process, it's going to make the dish better.
I hope so. At least if something goes wrong, I know I was paying attention the whole time, and I can say where it happened or when it got weird or whatever. But yeah, as soon as I'm juggling a couple dishes, it's always when I burn one or like forget the salt in the other. So I'm sure there are people who can juggle. They probably lots of people have done it, but I'm not the type.
The other part of the cookbooks and also the blog has been your photography. You're not a professional photographer, you're an amateur, but we have seen in the last 10 years, in the time of Smitten Kitchen being one of the premier blogs, an explosion of food photography. Instagram essentially made its name on people taking pictures of their food.
Of lunch.
Yeah, so talk about the concept of what you try to get out, because I love that there are photos attached to all of the recipes, but they're artistic. There's something really great about the way that the photography shows the meal, not necessarily the process.
Well, thank you. That means a lot, because I don't really – I mean, I know I take the pictures for my book, so I'm not going to say I'm not a photographer, but I don't really consider – I know what real photographers do to make beautiful photos happen, and I don't do that. I shoot on auto most of the time. I'm really lazy, but I'm sorry. But it's okay, because I'm not – I feel like it would be a bigger insult to real food photographers to pretend that going through hard. I'm not, but what I do is I just work with natural light. In general, my goal is to make the food the focus. I'd like it to be clear. I'd like it to be crisp. I generally try to keep it by the window in daylight so there's light on it. And I try not to, in part laziness and in part because I feel like philosophically opposed to it. I don't really want to make it look too cute, because what's the point of me having some gloriously perfect dish? And now you make my recipe at home that I've promised you is going to go well, and it looks awful, and now you feel bad about your cooking. Like, how does that fulfill my goals of getting you to cook something and being excited about it? So I just always want to keep the styling simple, and I felt that if I kept it as minimalist as possible and well lit, hopefully, and sharp, I didn't have to do a lot of flourishes or whatever. And that's it. That's all I do. I just try to take pictures in natural light and try not to. But I love all the food on Instagram. I love all the styles out there. I get so, sometimes I'll be looking at a food photo and it's so beautiful, and then I'm like, I don't even know what this food is. I don't care. I want to eat it because it's so beautifully lit. Isn't that an Instagram thing?
It is. And in a way, I wonder if Instagram, social media has almost become the new wave of the first wave of amateur food blogs. When you think about your work and others where, you know, even if you think about middle 2005, 2006, mm-hmm. when you started, it's entirely different than what we see in 2017. First off, you were independent. Now it seems like every website, whether it was a food mm-hmm. magazine or not, has a food section and a food mm-hmm. blog.
Absolutely.
But talk about that. Talk about being at the beginning of a movement of food websites and where we're at today in 2017.
You know, I never realized that I was in the middle of a movement or anything. I mean, it was very amateur back then, or it was professionals doing this in their free time and talking about what they see in the kitchen, but it wasn't, I had no concept that this was part of something bigger. But I think I did know on some level that what the real reason that food blogs really exploded was that a lot of the larger media organizations hadn't gotten on the web yet. They kind of thought it was this inconvenience that was going to go away, which meant that even if you're like a nobody with no professional experience and you're out there, you could probably be on the front page of Google results. That wasn't what anybody was thinking about when they were doing it, but just by being there for a long time, you had more authority. At this point, everyone's figured out. Places that didn't have food are adding food. Places that have been doing food forever have very solid web organizations. It's not like a solo site could really compete with that anymore. I don't have the staff or any staff. My kids are fairly – I mean, I try to get them to help, but they're just fairly useless.
They play a role.
They're cute. They're not so good at web, you know, SEO and stuff. So I think it was really just a moment in time where a lot of people hadn't gotten to the web yet in the area. And so food sites that have been around for a while came in early and got more attention than they otherwise would have in the current market, I think.
Do you think you could do Smitten Kitchen from scratch now in 2017? If you said right now, Deb, I want to try some things in my kitchen. I want to be fearless, and I'm going to put up a site and see if it works.
You know, I have no idea. I feel like I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that it's me, and I am so awesome that no matter what I did and when I did it, people would have found me and I would have made a career of it. I have no idea, though. There are probably a lot of people starting out trying to figure out why it isn't happening as fast. But I do think, you know, I mean, I may not be entirely blog focused today. You know, I think you definitely need a nice collection of YouTube videos, and you definitely want to be on Instagram. And you could probably even run a lot of your site off of Instagram, mm-hmm. or a lot of it. You could certainly do a lot of the writing and the pictures on there. I think you might reformat it, but if hopefully what people want is what you're saying, it doesn't really matter where you say it.
You just wonder, though, the independent voice? Because a lot of the reason that people have followed you and are loyal to you is your voice, is the fact that they see a lot in you. They can relate to you. It's not coming from on top of the mountain, that kind of concept. Yeah. And I wonder if it's harder to get through thousands and thousands of more entries into the world of this world of the amateur food and amateur foodies, that it would be tougher in 2017. I'm sure it can be done, but it's about attracting and having that dedicated following.
No, I think it would definitely be a little more of an uphill battle. As I said, you'd be competing with a lot of places that have a lot deeper pockets. At the same time, I think for a lot of us, our favorite thing at newspapers and magazines are a certain columnist. We all have our favorite reviewers and whatever. And I think it's not a blog, but what it is about that voice. And so I hope there will always be a space for voices, because I have my favorite writers, and I don't care if their site looks like, garbage. Not that it's us, but you know what I mean? Like, it kind of, you would sort of find them anywhere, and you like their voice and you catch it in other things. I hope there's always a place for columnists and stuff, but I think it would be hard to start like a blog today and only as a blog enterprise and expect it to do what it did in 2006, because it's not 2006.
With that being said, what's next for you? Do you find yourself, are you going to stay with smittenkitchen.com and stay with a presence there and continue to write cookbooks? Or do you see a sunsetting of that project, which has been tremendous for the last 10 years?
I have no idea. My fantasy is that I get to keep doing it as long as I enjoy it. I have no desire to quit a blog. I'm writing cookbooks now. I'm not going to do it. I really love the day-to-day of it. And my fantasy, I'm sure this is true for a lot of people's jobs, I'd like to get tired of it before it gets tired of me. So I'm going to keep being there. I don't have any other great plans for my life. If I ever write another cookbook, it would be a very, very slow experience. This one took 5 years, so I wouldn't be... Anyway, so I'd like to keep doing it. I don't really want to go anywhere. I like to check out other opportunities as they come up, but I'm not... I don't know. I'm not over it yet.
Author and food writer Deb Perlman, my guest in studio tonight on Industry Night. She is the author of Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. She's also the author and creator of the great blog, smittenkitchen.com. Deb, great to meet you. Thanks for being here, and thanks for being our guest tonight. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me in.
Good to talk with Deb Perlman. Smitten Kitchen, very influential blog. Maybe she can help me with my crockpot issues. We'll see. Coming up, the safes, Studio 435. I had a caller, 847, called in a little bit earlier and mentioned that early. I was talking about my New York trip, and I got two things in right there. I got one that was, I messed up the cab. I had to go, I had to go get fine cash, pay this guy. And the second was and I'm not even sure if the Hasidic Jews, maybe they weren't Hasidic. Maybe they just give Hasidic Jews a bad name. I don't know. Mm. But he had gone out of his way to say that the Judaic religion, Judaism, is one that doesn't proselytize. It's not one that goes out on the street corner. So they're not
part of that group.
Right. They're not true blue. So... in that regard, I feel like he wanted me to say that so that people out there are like, man, Jews are pretty pushy. No, that's not the case.
Yeah.
These are the guys that stand in Times Square and then they ask everyone, are you Jewish? And then if you say yes or anything, they aggressively walk with you for a half a block trying to get you to buy a bracelet.
This is not anything. I mean, I guess it's religious, but it's nothing to do with Judaism.
No.
It's like as much to do with Judaism as the naked cowboy.
Right. The end game probably for them is, in the way that they're, I don't know, I'm going to look at it and go, you know what, I was thinking about converting. Thanks for the weird flyer. That doesn't make any sense. And that, okay, sounds good. And thank you so much for being so aggressive. The fact that you walked with me as fast as I was walking and kind of stuck your shoulder into mine really makes me think, I'm thinking one religion, this might be it. No. I'm going to go quick. Had the best ramen ever had.
Oh.
Momofuku noodles.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
I mean, is it easy? We wanted to start off slow because
David
Chang,
right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we were going to eat a lot. You know, on the weekend. So we're like, let's just keep it cash. Let's hit some ramen, $160 ramen.
Oh, my God.
So ridiculous, dude.
Did you see where the buns on that menu?
Yep.
Those are supposed to be like the best things ever.
Oh my God, that's I would say 130 of the bill was the buns. We were going crazy.
Hey, be careful. Sexual harassment talk.
That's right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, too much. No, but it was $160. When we were done, we were laughing. But I would say that, you know, they get you on the booze. So when I'm like, oh, a Chenin Blanc. Oh, what a great bottle. I guess we'll get a bottle here at this ramen shop. I guess it's just expensive. That's New York. The pigeons and the squirrels in Washington Square Park were very aggressive as well. Maybe not as aggressive as the Iron Mans and the Minnie and Mickey's in Times Square, where every time, like, we went to Times Square and you go to take a picture of it, you're like, wow, this is amazing. And they get in the photo. They see, they're looking for you to pull your phone out so they can get in your photo so that you will, I guess, go, oh, I got, you know what, I'll take a picture with you. Here's $5. It's the most, and I asked my friend who's like, was born and raised in New York City, lives in Staten Island now. And she was like, it's new. It's like something in the last 10, 15 years where they've decided the best way to get tourists is to be as hyper-aggressive mm-hmm. as possible with your weird characters and things that you try to get to take pictures with.
Yeah, because before that, they were just barfing on your shoes, and now we've got these obnoxious characters.
I would rather take the barfing on the shoes, to be honest. Like, there was one. This is how suave they are. They had a couple of Elmos, and I walked past the staging area where you had like four Elmos and nine Iron Men.
Staging area?
Yeah, it was just like an area that, it was almost like this is where we chill before we go out and
is that like a cab thing at O'Hare?
This is a lot like that.
18 billion cabs?
One of the guys was standing, there were two, there was a Cookie Monster and an Elmo, right? And the Elmo had his head off, and he was wearing a surgical mask. You know, sometimes you see that when people walk around with the surgical mask on. So he's there and holding the head in his arm. And I was like, oh, that'd be a great picture. And I realized that's how he stands. He's doing that for me to go, oh, that'd be a great picture. Like, they've adapted. They're like, we can be ironic. we got something for everything here. You want to catch me in various states of undress? $5. That was amazing to me. Anyway, all right, coming up, the Safes, Studio 435. It's a download. Time for Studio 435 here on 720 WGN, our Monday Night Showcase, featuring live music from the best Chicago has to offer right here in our All-State Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Tonight, a return engagement for Chicago's The Safes. The rock and roll band just put out a new album this fall. It's called Tasty Waves, out on Hidden Volume Records. And they just came off an amazing tour from all over the country. They're back in town. They're playing Beat Kitchen on Wednesday night. Patrick and Frankie O'Malley and Dave Elliott in studio. And here they are with their first track tonight live, the track Hometown. Take it away, guys.
Measure up to me.
The safe's in Studio 435 tonight. Come on over to the table, guys.
All right.
That was Frankie and Patrick O'Malley, Dave Elliott on the bass. That was a track, Hometown, which is off Tasty Waves, their new album just put out this fall on Hidden Volume Records. The band, of course, Chicago band, were here probably about, I would say, what, 8 months ago, 9 months ago?
Yeah.
Great to see you guys.
Great to see you, too. Thanks for having us back.
Feel like we're buddies.
Yeah. We are buddies.
We are buddies. Last time we were in, we had a great conversation. I remember it distinctly, talking about family, talking about art and music. You also made a big point about the fact that, you know, music is about hustle. It's about hard work. It's about putting it together. Let's talk first off about Tasty Waves. Put us from in January talking about getting new music together. Talk about the process of getting this record to print.
Okay, so in January we had the rhythm tracks done for Tasty Waves, and we needed to and the vocals, and we needed to do the overdubs.
Right.
And we have a home studio, Patrick, and Patrick records all of the overdubs, the extra guitars and keyboards and background vocals. So we locked ourselves in the studio for a few months and finished that off and then mixed it. And then we headed over to our friend Brian Deck, who worked with us on the album, and we mixed it with Brian. And while we were working on it, we were sending it around to some independent labels. We got a couple interested, and the best deal, the best offer, the thing that made the most sense was teaming up with Hidden Volume. They were very into the album, and they were into everything we were putting into it, which was, you know, like 3 months of being on the road touring.
The hustle.
Yeah, the hustle part.
That's what attracted you, was the fact that the hustle has to be a part of any sort of deal that you guys get?
Well, yeah, some people, you know, certain labels would be asking for a percentage of back-end royalties on licensing and business type things, and when we talked to Hidden Volume, there was no talk about that type of stuff. It was more of an understanding of a realistic DIY approach to doing rock and roll. It wasn't, you know,
right.
Weird.
We combined forces. They have their own method of releasing records and presenting records and distributing records internationally. So they were going to do their hustle, and then we had our own.
Yeah,
our own thing that we do, and we just join forces and try to get it out there to as many people as possible.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. We're fans of Hidden Volume, and Hidden Volume were fans of us. We had the great fortune. Our friend Kurt Schmelz, who plays bass with us on the road, he booked us with the owner of Hidden Volume's band on tour in 2014.
Okay, right,
so
okay.
He saw
so you guys
us,
have seen, yeah,
and then he came out to see us again and again, and then as Hidden Volume kept putting out records, I was like, that'd be a great label for us. And, you know, we became friends with Scott, and it kind of became an organic thing where we, you know, called him on the phone and talked about it, and it was like a one conversation.
Well, this, I mean, the record's doing great. I mean, you guys are, when we were in here before, I mean, the idea that this is your, you got a label now and the record's out. I mean, you guys are showing up all over the place, which is awesome. But there is still a hustle part of this, in the way that, you know, getting some good buzz and people liking the music you put out, just almost you put it in the next gear. I mean, you were explaining to me before we came in, Frankie, just the how big the tour has been.
Like, yeah, I haven't had a weekend off since the last weekend in August.
Just going.
But that's the way you want to live your life.
We're playing rock and roll.
Yeah, it's the best thing to be doing, you know. So we're blessed to be able to do it.
Yeah, we're professional musicians.
You told me this is the smartest tour that the Safes have ever done.
Well, I really believe it is. Thanks to Dave, we have the luxury of having great friends and musicians. Brian Dexter, Kurt Schmelz, and Dave Elliott. We couldn't do it without those three guys. We broke the tour up into two-week tours, one to the East Coast, because you need to play on a Monday night in Cleveland and a Tuesday night in Pittsburgh, and every so on to get to Boston and New York. You have to play Columbus, Ohio on the way home, and you have to play, you know, going out west, you have to play Springfield, Missouri, and, you know, all these
for routing
these
reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
if you're going to route it outright.
So on the last tour, when we did a five-week tour straight, and we spent the last week in the Midwest, and we were playing Milwaukee and Green Bay and Madison and Minneapolis on
on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and the shows were duds, and we're like, we usually kill here. And then we were like, it's because we're playing on Sunday and Monday.
Right.
These are cities we're hitting more frequently.
On Friday and Saturday.
Yeah,
so
right.
What we should do next time is play all our good Midwest towns on Fridays and Saturdays exclusively, and then break the coast tours up to two-week tours. So we did that, and it worked out really great. I'm very happy to be home and to have accomplished it all. I remember before the tour, Dave said to me, I wonder what you're going to think of taking this approach to, because we've been touring for 14 years, and this is the first time we did it like this. I remember Dave specifically asking me, like, I wonder what your opinion of this is going to be, because, like, you're going to be on the road for 3 months, dude, and I was like, I didn't think about it like that. And he's like, you know, he told me, I looked at your website and I started having an anxiety attack because Dave only did the Midwest dates. Our two friends from the Baltimore and DC did all of the 2 week tours. And Dave's like, oh, I only have to do the weekends. And then I was like, oh my God, I don't have a weekend off until Thanksgiving.
Well, you know, people don't think about that, especially bands.
I certainly didn't until Dave mentioned it.
I'm happy to go out there and do
But I mean, just I'm intrigued because bands that the way to not just make money but to market your music is to be able to be in that kind of rotation where you're constantly gigging, you're out on the road,
that's the lifeblood.
And there is a science and a technique to that. I mean, the best bands and the ones have to be efficient. You have to think ahead three cities. You have to think that you got to play Cleveland here to get to Pittsburgh, to get to Boston. I never really think about that, but that could go astronomically bad.
Oh my God.
If you're not thinking ahead.
There, you can look at the routing of some bands that are even major label bands and you
what do you mean routing? Like routing?
Yeah. You'll look at I will look at tours and I'll be like, that's a 22-hour drive. Like, and the way it works out is they have a bus driver and they all sleep. They go to sleep right after the gig. They wake up and they crawl, you know, they get on stage and they play the next gig. And, you know, I mean, we don't have the luxury. We share the driving responsibilities ourselves. You know, I mean, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll.
Well, I always tell a story because happenstance, I was in Nashville a couple of years back, and I had dinner with friends, and one of the guys from Cage the Elephant was there.
Oh, nice.
Right? I was at the table. I didn't know much about the band, but I started talking to him about his life, and I said, how often do you get up to Chicago? He's like, we get up there a lot. We play the Aragon. Is that what it's called? Like, that's funny. But what he said, I go, so do you get out and you see? And he's like, to be honest, no. He's like, our tour bus pulls up in front of the Aragon. You have the choice to go in if you want and sound check, and they'll sound check, and then everyone gets back on the bus until the show, and they get on the bus and the show, and then when they're done with the show, they're gone.
Yeah.
Like, you're right. They're the kind of band that, because of their success, they're at the point where they're climbing that mountain and they're doing the 22-hour drive. But they don't take time to check out the sights or go get coffee or have dinner. It's business.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the good things about being at the level we're at is we get to enjoy things like that. There are some long drives, but there wasn't a single double-digit hour drive on this entire tour.
That's great.
I think the longest was less than 8 hours. Which, you know, in a lot of that, I mean, that's, you know, not too bad, but we got to spend a lot of time doing fun things in addition to playing rock and roll.
You know, for you guys to be a band that is on the way up and getting a lot of great buzz in Chicago and people talking about your stuff, how do you get people to a Tuesday night show in Denver or a Thursday night show in Pittsburgh? I mean, how does that work for Ben? It used to be like try to get, I mean, I was only thinking like 70s and 80s, like try to get on the radio station there. Mm-hmm. But with internet,
we do that.
But how do you do it?
Well, we do that. This album made it to the top 40 on college radio.
Great. Congratulations.
We mailed it to all the music blogs, all the daily newspapers. We got coverage on a bunch of those.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember last time our nephew Patrick was here. He made a great animated music video which got premiered by Stereo Gum, which helped. And
because it promotes the tour, promotes the upcoming album, things like that.
So a national music publication gave us a high profile
and that
video
works.
Premiere.
That it works does. In the sense that kids will come out from
Pittsburgh
or whatever.
Because Stereo Gum is you know, it's like top five on most influential music blogs. And then the second video our friend James Glass made was premiered by Big Takeover, another industry.
You guys have been doing this for, like you said, you've been touring for 14 years.
Yeah.
Do you notice the difference? Do you notice when something gets in stereo gum or other,
sure,
other things?
Definitely.
Do you notice you go to like I said, a Pittsburgh or a Denver and you're seeing a crowd that wasn't there
before?
Sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Write-ups in daily newspapers or interviews, yeah, we'll see people coming out. For sure, no doubt.
It definitely helps. I mean, the college radio helps more in the kids who are working at the station. If they get excited about the record, you'll see them more so than there's a big audience of people listening to college radio. Right. But it definitely helps. And you know, being in the Tribune, they did a half page article on us the other day. That's huge.
Do you feel, I just love talking. The Safes are in studio tonight, Frankie and Patrick O'Malley, Dave Elliott as well is here. You know, and we're talking about the success of the album Tasty Waves, you're playing Beat Kitchen coming up here on Wednesday, you're back in town, we're talking about the tour. And I love the fact that you know, I had the chance to meet you guys 9 months ago or whatever, I guess 11 months now, but 11 months ago, being in studio talking about your lives as musicians, and be able to talk about getting to the next level. And as you guys continue to climb and you continue to work and you continue to hustle to see the success, I am intrigued to get at what the feelings are. I mean, do you recognize that? Do you say
yes?
Yeah, you're like, yeah, I know our hard work is paying off. I could see it in audience. I could see it in making the top 40. I can see it in the way people treat us. What is it, right?
It's all of it. It's the the ability to continue to do it. It's the privilege and the blessing to be able to continue to do it. And we do. Yeah. I mean, like I said, like I'm happy to be home that we made it. We played every gig. We sold records every night. We sold t-shirts every night. We, you know, played in front of audiences
played
in different
with great
cities.
Bands.
Yeah, we made new friends in every city. That's another huge component of actually being a touring band is it's really the friends you make in each city.
Right, the relationships.
It's the people that help you book that show in Pittsburgh, in Cleveland, in Baltimore, in D.C. Like the friendships you develop with the people in every city. You know, that's the lifeblood of a DIY touring band.
Yeah.
And, you know, the privilege to be able to do it, you know, I mean, it's really the act of performing. I love it's all for the 40 minutes I'm on stage, you know, I mean, like Dolly Parton said, you know.
That's right. I consider you guys to be Dolly Parton philosophers.
Yeah, I love Dolly Parton.
Yeah. Okay, so here's what we'll do. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and we will get some more music. Safes are in studio, Frankie and Patrick O'Malley, Dave Elliott as well, in tonight. They are playing at Beat Kitchen coming up Wednesday night before Thanksgiving show.
Classic. Yeah. And this will be the 14th year we've done it.
Really?
Yeah.
At Beat Kitchen?
Yeah. At Beat Kitchen a bunch of times, but we've done it at several other
venues. But
you
love playing on that Wednesday night before Thanksgiving?
It's a good night. Yeah, it's a good night to do. And it's a record. It's our record. It's our Chicago. So the record's been out since September 8th, but this is the first night it's available in Chicago. So
awesome.
Bring your gig money and bring your merch money. We're selling
two different pockets.
We have two. Right? This album is on. It's on two colors vinyl. It's on electric blue vinyl, sea blue vinyl, and compact disc.
I love that. That's retro now. The compact disc.
The compact disc is the retro thing. We still do have that.
Do you have the long boxes?
Yeah. We went back to the long boxes too.
All right, the Safes are in studio. We'll hear some more live music. The album's Tasty Waves are playing Beat Kitchen in Roscoe Village on Wednesday night. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get the update from Rob Martyr on tonight's news, and we will continue. Stay with us. Thank you, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it's time for Studio 435, the second half of Studio 435, our Monday Night Showcase, featuring live music from Chicago bands right here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. The rock and roll band The Safes in studio tonight. Their album Tasty Waves is out now. It's getting great reviews, great buzz. They just went on a big tour all over the country. They're back in town for the unofficial record release party here in Chicago at the Beat Kitchen, coming up on Wednesday night, right before Thanksgiving. Patrick and Frankie O'Malley here, Dave Elliott as well, on bass, They're back with another track. Here we go, guys. Disposable Outcome. Take it away.
Pounding your chest like a drum. There is one thing that will last. Once it's gone, and that's your past. You can change your hair, cut clothes, but where you came from never goes. While the price of something free is dangling over me, you consume your pint of blood while you fling gallons of mud. Pound in your chest like a drum. Disposable outcome. All the eggshells that I break, walking miles on my tongue, eating piles of your dung. I can tolerate the taste and afford the time we waste to establish that you're tall and that I am very small. Pounding your chest like a drum.
There we go, the Safes, live in studio 435 tonight. It's Frankie O'Malley, Patrick O'Malley, Dave Elliott in studio. The track Disposable Outcome. They're going to be playing at the Beat Kitchen coming up on Wednesday night. It's the unofficial record release party for
It is official. I think it's official for it's the official Chicago release party.
Okay, official Chicago release party for
because
we
made Chicago wait. We brought it all over the country. We made our hometown wait for the official Chicago release.
The band The Safes in studio, the album called Tasty Waves. When you do that, I mean, do you have to resist the urge or give in to the urge of making a show like that special? When you get to come home after a long tour and you do a show that you guys do all the time on a Wednesday night on Thanksgiving, there's tradition. It's the official release party. What do you got to do? I mean, do you approach a gig like that differently?
Yeah. We almost book every single time we go on tour and put out a new record, we make Chicago the last date of the tour, so we are so road tight. Because when you go on tour and play that long, you get better. You perform better. So Chicago will be getting our best performance. And they haven't had a chance to buy the album in person until this coming Wednesday night.
It's
and
very
they can.
Important.
As you already said, there's several different colors and styles.
Yeah, there's two different colors. It's on CD. We're playing with some great local bands. I'd like to name the bands we're playing with. We're playing with The Hustle, which is our nephew Alex's band. Little Boy Junior and our good friends of The Difference, and we're looking forward to playing. All three bands are really great, and we're really happy they're on the bill.
The last time we talked, and I loved that conversation, we talked about how your musical family. I
mean, yeah,
your mm-hmm. other brother also plays in the band.
Yeah,
and your nieces and nephews.
Yeah,
and learning at an early age music. It's a big part of the O'Malley clan thing, right?
Yeah, that's the next big hustle is figuring out how to get people in the music industry interested in that family album. Because it's not a rock and roll album, it's more
it's orchestral.
Of a, yeah, it's different. It's not what we've. It's not the network of people we've developed relationships with. It's outside of that. We're gonna have to hustle our way into a new crowd of people or something.
Dave, is it a plus? I mean, you've been playing music for a while. Is it a plus, a minus to work with family that's not yours necessarily?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's super easy. I mean, they're good songs, right? They're good bass parts. I love playing them. I love learning all the old ones that their brother Michael wrote. I mean, as a bass player, it's like really awesome because it's like, oh, this, you know, Michael plays totally different than I play, and Frankie writes stuff totally different than what I used to write in my other bands, and Kurt plays things different, and getting to just absorb all of that is a lot of fun. And it's really easy when the songs are there. And
right.
So.
And the other thing I want to say with Dave Elliott and Brian Dexter and Kurt Schmelz is these guys are – Dave's from Maryland, Kurt's from Baltimore, and Dex is from Virginia. And we met them from touring. We went out and toured, and we didn't know them at all until we played with their band in D.C. and Baltimore. And then we booked them in Chicago, and then we started doing shows together. And as our brothers got married, started their families, and couldn't do the road anymore, you know, our cousin Patrick came in. He played bass for a while. Right, then right. He got married and moved to New York, and he couldn't play. And then we were like, well, who are we going to ask to join our band? And we've been like,
which family member is left?
Well, then we were like, well, we spent 2 weeks on the road with Kurt and the Lexington Arrows, and we've been on tour with the Shakedowns, and we've been on tour with, you know, these guys, and we're like, and we got along every night. We didn't fight. They're great professional musicians, so we're very lucky. I mean, touring brought us that.
Right,
touring
right,
brought
right.
us the opportunity to tour beyond family being there.
You know, touring also brings perspective, and to be in a different town and to soak up what you can. You're not doing the big Cage the Elephant tour yet, where you're 22 hours. Talk about Chicago as a rock and roll town. I mean, where does it stack up? I mean, you go and play all these different clubs and all these different places, some that are more rock and roll than the other.
Chicago is you can hear great music any night of the week. There's a great industry, meaning there's great radio stations, music critics that help out. Chicago music fans are great. It stacks up. I mean, Chicago's the real deal.
Sorry to interrupt, but there are so many good music venues. There are so many good bands. There are some, like, you have local bands on WGN. I mean,
how cool is that?
There's it stacks up. It's great. I mean, not every city has what Chicago has.
Right.
Chicago is it's the real deal.
Well, I always think about because they'll always say, like, a town like Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
They say that if you go to any bar in Nashville, they have a band playing in the. I think it might even be a city ordinance that you have a band in every bar.
Right.
And they always talk about you can feel it. You can feel that it's ingrained in the culture there, where they're just really accepting of live music. But when you really start stacking it up, population wise or size wise or how many bars are in a city, how many live rooms there are,
right.
Chicago actually has more.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Because of the size of the town, but Chicago and obviously New York, LA, place like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Chicago doesn't get you never actually when you say the word Nashville to anybody, they go, "Oh, music." But when you say the word Chicago to anybody, it doesn't stack up to be the number one thing.
Well,
that's
this is something about Chicago that is sadly not represented, and that's the history of music in Chicago, which Buddy Guy talked to the former mayor Daley about. He said, when you go to Memphis,
right,
it's everything is Elvis Presley and Sun Studios. And when you go to New Orleans, everything is Louis Armstrong and jazz and Zydeco music. And when you go to
Nashville, it's a country music hall of fame.
Nashville, it's this. He goes, but you fly into Chicago and you don't see any pictures of Muddy Waters. You don't see any pictures of Howlin' Wolf. You don't see anything about Johnny B. Goode being recorded in Chicago or the Rolling Stones recording Satisfaction on Michigan Avenue, right down the road from where we are.
Right.
Johnny B. Goode was recorded.
A lot of cities like embrace that culture, that history.
And Chicago
does, but not in a way that it's
Chess. Chess Records is one of the birthplaces of rock and roll. I mean, Chicago is where rock and roll. I mean, it's one of the, it's as important as Memphis, St. Louis, New Orleans for rock and roll. I mean, all the people that I just named. I mean, the Rolling Stones came here to record at Chess Studios because of Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Chuck Berry. I mean, and Bo Diddley and the rest, all of the artists on Chess Records. So, I mean, that it's sad that part of Chicago's music history doesn't have the light shined on it.
Yeah, you're right. And it's a big enough city that you could put, I mean, because there has been calls for there to be a blues museum here in Chicago and other plans and construction, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but there isn't, and there should be.
Right.
You
could easily in this town consider a huge building that could be a blues museum that would rival what they have for the Country Music Hall of Fame.
No doubt.
Well, yeah, and the thing about Nashville. it is the impact that it had on the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, who,
Changed the game.
It changed the world.
Yeah.
Right.
And it started here. So it's a little disappointing that that isn't recognized.
Right, right.
As far as like modern rock and roll and what's going on now, it's great. And there is a great I think there's a lot of support and a lot of bands and, you know, outlets and this and that. But I don't know. I'm a music history guy.
I love it. And we didn't even mention, I mean, Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a soul movement here.
And
I guess with rock and roll, and I always think about rock and roll and the music that you guys do as I mean, obviously there's so much to hear when you talk about places like even Bee Kitchen, but you talk about Empty Bottle or you talk about the Metro and other Hideout and all the places in between. But I wonder how much that is concentrated, how much that comes out of, you know, when you go, like you said, you go to Memphis or Nashville, that's the heartbeat. That's the soul. That's the backbone that you know where you're at. Mm-hmm. And in Chicago, I mean, Smashing Pumpkins and maybe Ministry, mm-hmm. those kind of bands represent rock and roll. And there's others, Urge Overkill and things like that. But mm-hmm. you don't necessarily think rock and roll when you come to Chicago.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Well, you should, because Johnny Be Good was recorded here. And Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. Right. I mean, Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Bo Diddley. Right. I mean, I don't know. To me, it's mind-boggling because it should be. It should be the first place people think of, if not the second, you know, to Memphis maybe. I don't know.
When you guys, and you mentioned, you know, being road tight, you know, yes. coming to Chicago to play Bee Kitchen, you just came off of all these shows mm-hmm. around the country. You get tighter as a unit and the chemistry. Mm-hmm. Does it also help you as musicians to think about your next work? Do you know the chemistry that goes along with playing and getting tighter? Does it help you as a songwriter? Does it help you with,
yeah,
I know these songs so well now, I know how I want to evolve to the next project?
I find on tour that I get more ideas for songwriting, for lyrics. There's something about the freedom of the road that opens my mind for songwriting. As far as having a project to finish, we have a million projects going on all the time. And picking one to actually right. finish might be more of a, you know, something that takes actual critical thought. Whereas the creative side of it, being on the road, I have tons of ideas for songwriting where I don't when I'm at home. I mean, I write songs all the time, but like there's a different type of idea of songwriting. I wrote a bunch of Tasty Wave songs when we were on tour promoting Record Heat. I remember being like, in the van, verses coming to my mind, and then getting to the next, you know, person's house we were staying at, and grabbing the guitar and figuring out what the chords were, and you know that happens on the road.
Do you notice from having a tour like you just did, and the creative ideas that come from it? Do you notice a change in the direction of the music, or an evolution, or an artistic direction that might be different than what you've done in the last record?
Definitely, because it's always the new experience and the new exposure to whatever weird, crazy things that happen. Because the road is crazy. Mm-hmm. It's not a predictable thing. It's not like Cage the Elephant where it's, we drive 22 hours, we sit in front of the club, we play, we drive. We don't know where we're going to end up at night. And when we wake up in the morning, we don't know where we're going to end up or what's going to happen. We don't.
Sometimes where we're at.
Sometimes we're like, where are we? Yeah. You get lost. And it's a mystery, and it's a constant adventure. Yeah. So it puts your mind into a place which is great for creativity and great for writing.
Yeah, that's Frankie O'Malley, Patrick O'Malley, and Dave Elliott as well here. The Safes talking about their new album, Tasty Waves. They got a show coming up on Wednesday at Bee Kitchen. This is their annual Wednesday before Thanksgiving show. They will be at Bee Kitchen in Roscoe Village. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We got one more in you. We'll do one more here.
Sounds good.
Live song here, awesome. Studio 435.
Thank you.
Stay with us. It is a download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435 wrapping up tonight with the band The Safes, rock and roll band with their new album Tasty Waves, which came out this fall. They just did a massive tour of the country. They are ending the tour at the Bee Kitchen on Wednesday night. Back in town for the official album release party. Yeah, for Tasty Waves. These guys have been here before. It was a pleasure to have them back. We got Frankie and Patrick O'Malley and Dave Elliott as well on the bass. And here they are, The Safes, with the track Mediocre Jokers. Take it away, guys.
1, 2, 3, go! Jokers from the Hate Brigade, alcoholics, super soakers with the greenish shade on your coat of envy that I never gonna fade. You can't do it for yourself, so you just rain on our parade. You see, of course, only the mouth of this gift holds, but you're blind to its rich sauce. When a person can't say thank you is when good luck becomes tough, and we only get a blank you grumbling a bogus bluff. Can we break this piggy bank you keeping track of all this stuff? You see, of course, only the mouth of this gift calls, but you're blind to its rich sauce.
Go the Safes live, Studio 435 tonight. The show, the album release party will be at Beat Kitchen coming up on Wednesday. The album is called Tasty Waves, which is out in Hidden Volume Records, and of course, this is their return engagement. More to come from the Safes. They are having such a tremendous run right now with Tasty Waves and the tour that just ends at Beat Kitchen.
Sadly.
Frankie.
Well, we have some potential good news on the horizon.
Ooh.
That we don't know is for certain, but
no.
we might be going to some other country soon.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
But we'll put that in the developing scrawl. We'll put the developing.
Fingers crossed, but there are some things Hidden Volumes is doing to try and get us out of America.
All right, I like to hear that. Yeah. Chicago's The Safes going international.
Yes.
Developing. Yes. Right. Frankie, Patrick, Dave, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate you guys coming back.
Thanks for having us, Justin.
That's going to do it for the download tonight. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for his work on Studio 435. Safes, check them out Wednesday.